explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Acting. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Greetings, Earth Explorers. I'm Brooks Sacco, your host. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. My AccuWindow forecast says it's 86 degrees in western Kentucky, deep beneath the earth in a small town. Sunspots 904 and 910 are very small and close to the limb of the sun. They shouldn't cause any problems for us, although there may be an aurora borealis tomorrow. There will be an annular eclipse Friday the 22nd. Annular eclipses occur when the moon passes straight in front of the sun but fails to cover the entire solar disk. A sliver of sun pokes out in all directions, producing a vivid ring of fire. That's what's going to happen on Friday. But unfortunately, almost all of the eclipse takes place over uninhabited ocean. The red line in the map on my screen here shows that the traces of the path of annularity, where the sun will become a ring for about 7 minutes. It's only a tiny swath of Guyana, Suriname, and French Guiana. The only place where you'll be able to view the Ring of Fire. Next week on X Squared Radio, our guest is going to be Tom Van Flandern. If you have not read his book about dark matter, missing comets, and energy in space, that is a very interesting book. It's about 530 pages. It's not for the average reader. He is a 25-year veteran astronomer, and we're going to talk with him next week. It is going to be absolutely fascinating. One of the things that you may notice on X Squared Radio, if you go to our website, x2-radio.com, and make it your favorite place, is that the archives now cost a small fee in order to access. By small, I mean less than the cost of a cup of coffee per month. You can access it for a month for $2.50 or an entire year for only $20. The reason we're doing that is to cover the expenses of production. They are a very small amount of expenses, and we've been able to bring this to you for a year free of charge. You've been able to access all of those archives without any problem. So if you missed the show today, or if you have a friend that wants to, that you want to hear the show, just direct them to the archives, let them sign up, and they'll be able to access all of those going all the way back to September of 2005. We try to bring you the very best guests week by week here each Sunday evening, and we go into the depths of subjects that are not available on mainstream radio. And even on most paranormal radio stations, we cover maybe the same topics, but we go into a level of depth and a level of detail that you're not going to get from a regular radio entertainer. And we hope that that's interesting to you. I do appreciate the email. I received a piece of mail from a friend of mine, a radio friend of mine, James Gackle, want to congratulate him on the birth of his new son, and hope he appreciates the gift that I sent along for that. Tonight, our special guest has a reputation that is building to critical mass when it comes to predicting earth disasters such as earthquakes. His website is probably the most informative and accurate in the world when it comes to this kind of information. He's accumulated a lot of links in a very organized fashion. Go there, his website. I'll give you in a moment as soon as I introduce him. He's an expert on many subjects, not the least of which is Stargate, Atlantis, not only earthquakes, several expert things on UFOs, and his lovely wife is the one that does the part of the website on preparedness and disasters. And we're probably going to some of that detail tonight, because I just think most people have about a 2-day supply of groceries and wouldn't really know what to do if there was a disaster. I think all I really have to do is look at the news about how people handled themselves during Katrina, and that kind of tells the story about how people would be prepared. He not only has a special gift that is important for us all, he has solidified it into a message and a technology that may save your life very soon. The mainstream experts are starting to really take notice, so we thought, before he becomes too mainstream, we better get him on X Squared Radio. So please welcome with me Stan Deo. How are you tonight?
I'm fine, Brooke. I wonder if you could have your board operator turn up your volume a bit. I can hardly hear you.
Yes, I can maybe increase my volume a little bit on this end.
That's good.
That might help a little bit. All right. Sorry.
Where are you? Where's your location at the moment?
I'm in a small town called Madisonville in western Kentucky, and
we're over in Colorado, the other side.
Yeah. Well, oftentimes we get guests on here who are being interviewed in Australia, rebroadcasted in Belgium, and we take phone calls from Washington State. So technology is absolutely amazing how we can bring all this to bear.
And, that is amazing.
And I really don't think this even existed. This technology existed even 1 year ago. It was just, you know, fledgling. But now we can really do things that we could never do before. And the fact that we originate as a webcast, we're actually even able to stream video from a radio website, which has been really good. When I do sort of man on the street interviews, where I go to different conventions, I'll do a 3 or 4 minute interview, and I'll stick that on the website, and then you'll have an eyewitness to a UFO event, or an eyewitness to orbs that have been photographed, or voices that have been heard, and we'll put that on there. It's quite powerful, and that's just something that your normal AM radio station can't do.
Yeah, understood.
And Stan Deyo's website is Stan Deyo, StanDeyo.com, right?
That's correct.
And you just hit the entry link on there, and you will have enough information to keep you busy for weeks.
And that is true.
I, you know, there are arguments all the time over whether catastrophes are really increasing in vigor or whether we're just getting better at detecting them. Most of us have not had the opportunity of living more than 100 years or gathering direct data from other worlds. In our physical forms, we have very limited ability to see beyond the here and now. But there is much more to the human being that meets the eye. One of the things that fascinated me about your story is your early experiences and how they influenced your dedication to your mission today. Could you share that with us?
Well, yes. Can you narrow it down a bit? Which experiences?
Well, it seems like when you were young, you had the ability to dream about things, and those dreams would come to pass.
Yeah.
And I think you even met your wife that way.
Yes. Well, I knew she was coming that way, yeah.
I see.
Yeah, probably, gosh, this started happening when I was, 30? No, about 28, I suppose, somewhere in that region, 27, 28. And I used to use the yoga process of relaxing at night as I lay in bed. You know how you relax your toes and your mentally, you know, run up your body and relax all your muscles to get a good night's sleep. And around the time I started doing that, about 4:30 or 5 the next morning, I would be in a not awake but not asleep state, where I used to kind of have like what I would call the movie theater of the eyelids. I would my eyes would be closed, but I would be in like a CAD-CAM system answering questions that I had put to my mind before I went to sleep. Simple case would be like, these flying saucer type things, how would they work? And then when the answer came, I would get a color 3D CAD-CAM thing occurring in my eyes or in my mind so I could see it. That I could control my thought. I'd say, well, I want to see up inside that, and I would be zoomed up inside the thing, and I want to see the hole exploded apart, you know, or expand apart, so I could see how it all connects and what it does. And or it might be something like an equation, a problem with Einstein's thing, you know, the solution to it, and it would come in an equation form, floating in, I guess, dark space or sometimes space with stars, but. So that around the time I started doing that was when I started to have these prophetic dreams, and it was like an instruction. The first series of them I had occurred within 3 days, and the first dream showed me that I could see events that were happening real time. I dreamed that I was walking through a school canteen or cafeteria at night, and with someone, and I couldn't quite figure out who this person was, and I walked out into a hallway with them and sat down with books and stuff stacked beside me in a long hallway in the school. And the next morning I went to my office, and my secretary was there. We were talking
I had this weird dream last night, and I think it might have been you in there. I'm not sure. She says, what was it? And I told her. And I'd gone to bed early that night, and apparently she was going to an night school at a college right close to my house. And she and her husband had been locked in there late and had to go through the canteen and down the hallway to figure out a way to get out of the building. And I was actually there seeing that happen real time. So that was dream one, showed me that I can dream things that are happening, you know, or vision them at the real time. And then the next night I had a dream that showed me my number two son, who was, gosh, how old was he? He was probably about four going on five, and a real tomboy guy. I liked to climb the tree out the front of the house, but it was quite a dangerous thing because, you know, he was careless, and I was afraid he was going to hurt himself one of these days. But anyway, the dream showed me that he came home after school, climbed up the tree, and leapt out to grab a branch, missed, fell to the ground right in front of me, and hit his right leg, and broke it so bad that the bone stuck up through the flesh. And of course that got my attention, and so I woke up the next morning and told Mrs. I said, you know, we got to do something about that tree. That he's going to break his leg, you know. And she said, oh, well, you know, maybe. I said, look, I dreamed it. And so after the first night of that stuff happening, I thought, I'll tie some ropes around in the tree, so if he does get up there, he'll have something to grab should he start to fall. So that told me, okay, this may happen in the future. It wasn't happening real time. Well, then the next day, he came home from school, and darned if the little devil didn't get out there while no one was there, was climbing in the tree, fell, jumped for a branch, fell, but he caught the rope and let himself down to the ground without breaking his leg. So when I found that out, I realized that not only could I see into the future, but I could affect the outcome of it. So there were three lessons in that 3-day period. And after that, they were infrequent, but at major turning points in my life, I would see ahead of time, sometimes months, sometimes only a few weeks, and sometimes maybe 24 hours ahead of things affecting other people, like in plane crashes. I would see the plane crash in Europe, or mostly the European plane crashes. And sometimes I would be in the plane with the crew and the passengers, consoling them when they know they're going to die, when the thing was crashing. Weird stuff, but yeah, that's that kind of stuff happened starting back then. And I have had only infrequent, you know, as I got older, it happened less and less. But
Now I'm curious that because I've had similar experiences, although I've not been able to control it. It's sort of like I go to bed, or I take a nap in the afternoon, or I sit down in a chair on the back of my house and outside listening to the birds or whatever, and I kind of drift off. And I'm shown something, you know, without me soliciting it. And it's never something, you know, wonderful, like, you know, if you'll stand right here, there'll be a sack of money drop into your arms. It's always some kind of disaster, a train wreck, a plane crash, something like that. And I'm wondering if this kind of information doesn't just pour out onto the, you know, subspace networks, I guess. And those people that are in tune pick it up. And maybe those that are in a position to actually do something about it. I know my friend Dr. Stephen Greer actually called the president one night because he'd had a very strong premonition that if he went to a meeting in a foreign country, I believe it was Brazil, that they were going to try to assassinate him.
Right.
And he acted on it. He called, and they took it seriously and took precautions, and evidently, you know, it was avoided. It never occurred, but they took extra precautions, and from the feedback that he had gotten, there was something to be worried about there. I'm never, except for this radio program, never been in a position to say, you know, this is going to happen in this city, so people move out of the way. But have you ever had, besides your son grabbing the rope, which I found absolutely fascinating in your bio, that these, not only were you seeing the future happen, but you were interacting with it and rerouting it so that you chose a different route.
Right.
And it confirms for me that that there are all possible futures available for us.
Well, I don't think it's written in stone, you know, predestined, and we can't do anything, obviously. So, yeah, I agree. I think we can make changes.
Yeah, and it tells me that we are not necessarily just acted upon by the universe, that it's not just the way things were meant to be. We are source, actually. We have the ability to choose which path we're going to take or which precautions we're going to take based on the information that we receive. And I think, my own personal opinion, I'd like to get yours, that humans, by and large, have forgotten how to do this.
Well, yeah, I think I agree with that. I think that there have been very special persons through history that have maybe in the gene pool jumped ahead a bit and been able to do this, and they were, you know, the seers and prophets of their time. But I think now, as the gene pool is leveling out and we're unfolding for the, I don't know what it is, the 70th or 100th generation from the creation event for our particular species, that it's unfolding and allowing the children to see things, to dream things more so, a higher percentage than we've ever had. And I think eventually we will all have this sort of prescience of some sort, and it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. But I've had some of these things that weren't totally bad or notice of disaster when they relate to personal items. Some were good, and in the course of things, I guess I would say, but nearly all of them have some portion which is, as you say, kind of needing urgent action, you know, get prepared for it, or to make a decision on what you're going to do when this happens, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It gives you time to think it out.
Yeah, and one of the ones that really hit home for me was how you envisioned your wife and how she came to you. I know, you know, the person that I love, I dreamt about for years. Her face, her look, her mannerisms, her personality. And when I met her, I immediately knew it was her. And I was in love within 60 seconds.
Wow.
I don't know how it was with you.
Well, I didn't meet Holly, you know, face to face for, months, I guess. But, certainly we corresponded by email, just on normal business and things like that, until I realized that, you know, that it was bumping into something else. But it was knowing the person, you know, and certainly the first time we did meet, I flew out to meet her, flew from Australia up to California, and it was, as you say, you know, right then that, you know, this is it. So it was like, I used to be an artist when I was younger as a hobby, you know, painting portraits and stuff, and I used to fantasize about what my perfect lady would be like.
That's good. And so you were able to draw her. I'm afraid mine would come out like a stick person.
my brother Glenn is a surgeon, my younger brother, and I found out that he kept one of the chalk drawings I'd done of the lady that I would like to meet someday, and it hangs in his closet or something now. But yeah, I looked at it 2 years back when he showed me, and I said, "Oh, I forgot all about that." I said, yeah. Well, that's Holly.
What did she say when she saw that painting?
She's never seen it, actually. she wasn't with me when I looked at it. The thinking that he'd store it for me, but I told her about it, and you know, it's weird, but we. Everyone that meets us and stays around us, you know, for an hour or two or whatever, maybe not even that long, says, you know, you two guys are like two peas in a pod. You just,
yep.
Everything works together.
Yep, I know that exact feeling. Well, you seem to have developed a passion for becoming sort of a warning beacon for the world when it comes to earthquake technology. One of the things that have really put you in the limelight is your ability to predict earthquakes. And I guess that limelight at first wasn't so good, and now it's getting better. But can you tell us about how you developed this technique of earthquake prediction?
Well, it's kind of like it found me. Back in 1995, 95 it was, the U.S. Navy started putting up the Otis thermal anomaly map for showing the sea surface temperature variation, and they would put up the map twice a day. It's a really nice, still is, a really nice 256-color map of the world showing the temperature of the water from the equators, from the equator up to both poles. And then they also showed the anomaly, which I was interested in, which showed the variation over the last 30 days, the sudden cooling or heating of various parts, which was far more informative than just looking at absolute temperatures. And someone had sent me an email and said, hey, what do you think about this? This is a neat site. And back in 95, the Internet was still pretty young, and so I looked at that and I thought, wow, that is an interesting picture. And then the artist photographer side of me came out, the Photoshop guy, and I said, I wonder if I can determine a way to, take the second order differential, in other words, find the rate of change of anomaly, go one map further. So I did. I developed a technique, and I thought, well, that makes a nice map, but, you know, that's fine. And I stuck it off on my desktop, forgot about it. And, well, I guess around that same time, I was communicating with USGS, trying to get a program at work on my Mac to look at their earthquake databases because of the studies I've been doing in biblical history and prophecy and things about the increase of earthquakes in the last days. I wanted to see if we were getting an increase in earthquakes. So I had that on my desktop of the computer at the same time at one day, and I saw those pictures that I had stuck off to the side. So I, double-clicked the pictures and brought them up. I said, I wonder if any of these earthquakes are happening correlate to this anomaly chain somehow. And so I looked at it, and sure enough, a few of them appeared to occur right where these hot, cold, or rapid change and rapid cooling and heating occurred over fault lines. And I thought, well, I'll investigate a bit further, and I did. And I pulled in databases, and over the next 3 or 4 years, as I was using it, I increased the accuracy of it by adding, known fault lines and suboceanic bathymetry and topology on top of the ground, topography, and known fault lines on there and undersea. And late 95, it was only 4 or 5 months after I started doing this, Art Bell got hold of me. He said, look, do us a show and we'll talk about it. And I said, well, okay. And by that time, we figured out that the earthquakes would occur within 2 or 3 hours of me making the report, getting the report that day, and up to 5, 6, maybe even 10 days later, depending on how strong the signal was. And so that's how it started, and it has grown more accurate, I think, in time as I've learned more about which areas of the planet give what kind of signals off, thermally.
Yeah.
But all I do is I analyze the change in the rate of change of water temperature over fault lines when an earthquake is about to happen. And I don't know whether it's the release of radon gas or whether it's the Thompson effect or Peltier effect with piezoelectric charges migrate from one side of the fault line under pressure to the other as crystals fracture. I don't know exactly what is causing this temperature variation, but it is undeniable that it does give the signals ahead of time.
Well, that would be interesting to go to areas that seem to repeat this and take water samples and see what would happen. That's very similar to, when I started doing ground probing radar, one of the things that we noticed was it was pretty easy to find underground openings or fissures or cracks in the ground, and whether or not it had oil or gas in it, that was another thing. So we drilled quite a few dry holes while we were, developing the technology. And, of course, we analyzed existing holes that had been drilled, thousands of them, over 9 different states. And what I found was the very same thing that you're finding. We had to bring in other causes like radon migration and ethane migration and things like that. And we added instrumentation to our setup, but it would be very interesting to know if radon is effusing up into the water, because it has such a short half-life that it really means that a substrata opening has occurred and radon has been able to migrate much faster than it normally does to the surface and change the concentration. And that would be even maybe a more early warning signal than the thermal would be. But I find it fascinating that you use the government's own resource and develop this technique What did they do? When did you go back to them and say, hey, you know, if you'll...
Holly and I flew out to Monterey, California, to the Naval Center, the Fenlock Center there in Monterey, to the director of the project there and to the Dr. Singh. Well, it wasn't Dr. Singh at the time. It was another fellow, but the guy that had Dr. Singh's place now, or then. And we went into the facility and we told them, look, here's what we're getting, and here, you know, this is the accuracy we're getting at the moment. And the guy in charge of it, I'll just hold the names back because it is a secure, classified project deal. But he said, look, we see what you're doing, understand it. The bad news is that our data itself can have between 15 and 30% error rate in it because of cloud cover and various things that cause our sensors that we monitor to give us bad data or no data. And we have to then amortize over an area from nearby sensors or cloud range or whatever. I said, understood. And he said, however, although we can't endorse what you're doing because of the inaccuracy, and it's our fault, we will visit your website every day. And I don't know whether they've continued doing that, but certainly whenever I call the control room there at the Cray Computer Center there, whenever they're late getting it up or having a boot problem on the system, they do take my call and they do patch it through to Dr. Singh or whoever's in charge of the problem we've got, and they do rectify it.
And, of course, they sent you a regular check for that information.
No, no, I'm afraid not. I did do the right thing when the USGS here in Boulder, Colorado, when Waverly Purser was still the director there, he put out a news article saying, look, we're looking for alternate ways to forecast earthquakes, you know, new, unique ways to put together into a pool so that we can try to get a better picture of this.
Mm-hmm.
So I rang your secretary, you know, because they're just in the same state. And I said, look, here's what I've got, and I think it would be of help. You know, we need other data to put with it, I think, to go on land further, but see what you think. And she said, oh, I see what you're saying. Look, email me that stuff. Let me get it. She got it. She said, oh, that's fantastic. I'll take it to Dr. Person right now. I've never heard from him again.
Right, right.
So I assume that is for a number of reasons, but he was close to retirement at the time anyway, and it might have jeopardized that. But
well, has anyone else there given you an opportunity to prove yourself, or
no? You know, look, the I know this isn't a merit badge really, but the Mexican Naval Admiralty called me and put me on a conference call with all the admirals that were there, and they had seen what was happening on my earthquake forecast offshore, and they were setting up at the time, still are in fact, a tsunami and earthquake warning system for the Pacific side of Mexico. And they wanted to know how it worked, and, you know, did I need any help? And I said, well, look, if you can get the American Navy to put out the report I need twice a day, we can get really accurate. We can give you, you know, longer lead time. And they couldn't. Obviously, it didn't happen. So what we get from the Navy is the declassified version of that particular map. And I tried to let me have the classified version, and I would alter, you know, what was necessary to go to the public with what I do. But they wouldn't do that either. So, you know, one government, the Mexican government, tried to get them to do it, and I tried to go through USGS, and it's a stalemate. But understand this. I think if I were in a position of authority over myself doing this kind of thing, and we're trying to decide whether it's wise to let this information out to the public to the point of creating panic, I would probably defer to say, look, that guy's an unofficial source, and just let me go and keep feeding me this stuff. But if it got out of hand, everything said, oh, look, he's not an official source, he's just an amateur, and diffuse any crowd panic, but still get the information out. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I wonder, though, if people really would panic. I mean, look at the loss of life in December of 2005 or 2004 when we had the tsunami. You know, those people certainly panic when a 45-foot wave is coming for the shore. And I think it would be, if people would realize that this early warning information is out there, and if they live in a coastal city that faces a continental shelf that's prone to earthquakes, they should be socially ready for some kind of warning, a siren or something that says, hey, you've got, you know, 6 hours to pack up everything you've got, or 3 hours, there's a 600-mile-an-hour, 150-foot-high tsunami coming your way. Yeah, that's going to cause a big traffic jam, but I'll bet you that it would save a lot of lives.
Well, yeah, all right, let's take the other side of the coin. Let's say a person like myself gives the alert and a warning on a particular quake or, you know, risk factor in the next 2 or 3 days, and it is really serious, and people start preparing and cutting vacation short or whatever and going to the country lodge for a while up in the hills, and it doesn't happen. Then what do you do?
Yeah, sort of like a crying wolf. I mean, you're saying the conditions are right, the tension is there, the energy has been released, there's a good chance this could happen. If you have control over your situation, you know, fly back from Mazatlan early.
Yeah.
You know, and so the local community loses a few million dollars over the weekend because American tourists left early and no earthquake happened. Well, you know, what if the downside is much worse than that? I
understand that. I still do it. I mean, you know, Brooks, on the dream vision type side of things, which happens, you know, separate and apart from the scientific analysis I do, when Holly and I were down in Australia, living on the west coast of Australia at Perth, one day I had this, in fact, over that week, I had two, maybe three dreams that were just, I was in another country someplace, witnessing a terrible thing. There was going to be a huge caldera explosion. And I, you know, I saw people in a restaurant there, in a motel. I saw the name, or, you know, like the kind of motel. And I saw this crater lake behind him and steam rising up. And, you know, it's on my website there. We have a whole story about the Lake Taupo vision there. But anyway, when I had that, I'd never heard, I was in Australia in the West, I'd never heard of this place, probably 4,000 miles away on the other side of the country over in New Zealand in the North Island. And it's the Lake Taupo Caldera. And anyway, you know, I told about it. I wrote down the ascension facts about that, another dream about how no one would be able to know the exact, you know, time of it. And then we just forgot it. And then the lady came to our house to buy a book, who happened to be from New Zealand. And I said, do you know of any place around here in our area here that has a, you know, a lake like this and boats on it? And she said, you know, that sounds an awful lot like Lake Taupo over where I'm from in the North Island, New Zealand. So I looked on the internet and I saw pictures. And I said, well, it looks a lot like what I saw. And then forgot it again. Then about, I don't know, the next year, someone in North Island, New Zealand says, look, will you come over and deliver, you know, a lecture to us on what you talk about here at the University of Wellington? And, you know, I said, well, sure, okay. And I went over to do the conference there. And there, I said, look, Dolly, let's hire a car and let's drive to that Lake Taupo down the middle of New Zealand here in the North Island, and let's just see if it looks like what I saw in my dream vision. So we hired a car, and we drove down, and just as we got to the edge of the driving down into the populated area around the lake, she says to me, now stop the car right here. She said, tell me again everything that you saw, and I did. Describe the motel and the inside of it and where the bar was and, you know, where the staff was and what you could see. And then we drove into Taupo and found the edge of the lake and started driving around it. And blew me down right there. We passed this motel.
Oh, no way.
There it was. I said, that's it, stop, that's it. And we got out. I walked into the motel, and I said to her, follow me, I know where I am. And I went down a hallway, turned left, walked right into the staff sitting around tables in this little, like, a bar sandwich coffee shop.
There was
shop.
The window overlooking the lake.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
And so, okay, that was impressive. And so we went through all of it, and then that night later, the ground was steaming around the lake, and we thought, boy, wow, this is serious. It's warm here, and grassy yards were having steam come up through it. And we left and went back to Auckland, I think it was, and then came back. And the next day or two after we finished the business up there, and stopped off to talk to the earthquake seismologist people at the GNS services there in Tampa for the government. And we were talking to them, you know, and I kind of said, look, I know this sounds strange, but here's what happened. And they didn't laugh at me or anything, but, you know, they kind of said, oh, yeah. And she said, well, we do more earthquake monitoring and temperature monitoring and volcano monitoring if we had money, but, you know, the New Zealand government won't give it to us. So I, you know, commiserated and went on, and we did a show with Art Bell from there at Taupo, and then went on home. We were notified by the news by the New Zealand Tourist Association that I was not welcome to come back to the country because I caused a minor panic to tourism. But what happened was over the next couple of years, the New Zealand government started funding those people there at the GNS with what they needed, money to get a German you know, little yellow submarine to go around the bottom of Lake Taupo and map the vent areas and what's happening, more money for sensor equipment and early warning. And so because of that, I went over and did that and caused the ruckus. They got money to help save more people by early warning. So that's part of that dream altering the future business.
Mm.
Interesting, isn't it?
That is great. That is awesome. Now, can these dreams that come to you, they come unsolicited, or can you put yourself into a state and try to explore? Or do you suggest, hey, I want to go see where the next earthquake disaster is going to be on the earth? You know,
no,
how is that process?
I guess in the early days when I was, you know, looking at the inside of things and you know, how the universe worked and equations and those saucer things I was telling you about, I did go to sleep and do the priming of my subconscious with what I wanted to know about. But nowadays, in fact, shortly thereafter, in the early days of my dreaming, I didn't do that anymore. Life would keep me pretty busy and pretty tired. And,
yeah.
You know, in short, I haven't done that anymore, although I think I probably could. Nowadays, when I hit the sack, you know, we're both so tired, we just kind of fall into bed and we're asleep by the time our head hits the pillow.
I know exactly what you mean. Two kids
in
college.
Things are pretty busy now, aren't they?
Yep. Two kids in college, and it takes a lot of effort to keep the keep the funding going. What about 2012? Is that on your visionary radar?
Well, not so much a visionary, but certainly the analysis of the timing from the scriptures and the Jewish and Christian Bible in the Torah and in the whole Bible, using several variations and trying to compensate for errors that occurred between the Septuagint version and the version that the Western world uses for the Bible. I think I've come up with 2011, 2012, somewhere near in the Vindicator Scrolls book as the end of this age before we start the next one. It's not the end of the world, just a transition period, but it does, strange enough, coincide with that based on, I think that was based on a generation of 70 and 75 years based from the Balfour Declaration, it was based on the formation of the new state of Israel in 48, I think. That's what it was. It's been about 20 years since I wrote that book, so I'm just trying to remember. But I do think there's a lot more we can find out in the ancient Hebrew, in the older versions of the Torah. I'm sure you're aware of that, having studied Zohar and stuff. But
we found many things in the Kabbalah that... They're a little cryptic, but some of them, if you look at them from a point of view of physics or even from a Tolkien calendar viewpoint, they seem to fall right into place.
Are you familiar with the Shagatnet crowns or the Tagin crowns over the Torah?
My co-author, E.J. Clark, is familiar with that. She is currently in our third volume, which is not going to come out till after we finish our North Pole expedition.
Right.
She has cracked the code of the Mayan calendar, and it's going to be quite revolutionary when we release that. But she's been studying that very closely.
I know it has something to do. I did study that too, and so much so that I learned a different way to translate the Hebrew. It's longer, but it's not where you use like Strong's Concordance or something like this. It's actually going into the every letter, every syllable of names and or verbs or words that are put down in the Torah. And surprisingly, about 85% of the time, I can translate more from that correctly than you could if you were using just normal Hebrew word and verb conjugation methods.
Less ambivalence?
Less. Oh, well, that's how we found out where the the Exodus and where that occurred, and about how the cyclone or like a hurricane set down over the top, a big tornado in essence, over the top of Israel and kept them separated from Egypt, and as part of the waters and the pressure. Like, that was a whole other study, but it's quite an interesting discussion, that one. But that's how we were able to find that. And down at the church I was at there in Australia, but I taught 12 other couples to read the Hebrew and translate like this after we found out that it worked by getting self-teach books from Behrman House in New York. And every Saturday for about 12 weeks we would meet and learn more together. But anyway, what I'm getting to is this. I checked this, the method I was using with a couple of rabbis who were teaching rabbis, and one of them was a physicist as well.
Yeah, I like that when they speak our language and they're linguists as well.
Oh, well, I got to tell you, do you have commercial breaks?
Yeah, I do at the top of the hour, right, straight up at 6 o'clock Central Time. We take about 7 minutes, but we run 55 minutes straight.
All right, I just want to be sure I didn't get in the middle of this and get caught. When I started doing this, I had my accountant was a Jewish fellow, and Richard said, you know, you ought to talk to our rabbi about that. And I said, oh, yeah, all right. You know, coming from the Christian side, even though my father was Jewish and everything,
right,
I said,
right.
You know, I don't know whether it'd go down well, but arrange it if you want to. So Richard arranged to meet with his rabbi here in Perth, and we drove up at the appointed time in the evening. I think it was about 6 in the evening, and the house, the rabbi's house, is all closed up. No lights on. And Richard said, hey, he's there. He's hiding. I said, are you joking? He wouldn't be hiding, would he? Oh, yeah, because, well, he knows, you know, you wrote that book and you're Christian stuff. And, you know, he's being silly. I'll go down. And so he knocked on the front door, no answer. He said, I saw a blind move in the back of the house. He's there. Be there. Just wait. Let me go by myself. So eventually he gets the rabbi to open the door about 2 inches. And the rabbi looked out at him, and they talked back and forth and pointed at me out in the car and this and that, and this goes on for a while. Pretty soon, Richard motions to me, come on down. So I get on down there, and the rabbi closes the door. He's going to go lock the family away in the back of the house so I don't contaminate them. And Richard says, well, the rabbi's going back to the house.
Yeah.
Whatever you do, he says, Stan, don't mention, you know, that name, you know, Jesus Christ or anything like that, because he thinks the roof will fall in if you do. I said, oh, I'll behave myself. So pretty soon the rabbi came back and let me into the living room with Richard there. We sat down, and the rabbi says, you know, you have some sort of a new method of translating the Hebrew. You want to explain it to me? And so I said, well, look, Rabbi, I'm just an amateur at this, but let me give an example in Melchizedek, I've translated it and got this information. I won't go all through the whole explanation here from here, but I did explain letter for letter, word for word, what it meant. And he said, ah, very good, except for one thing. He said, it's not Melchizedek, it's Melchizedek. It's the L and the K reversed. It's King Zedek. And I said, oh, sorry, Rabbi, I'm looking here in my Hebrew right here. It's Melchi, the other way around. He said, what book are you? Oh, no. Look, I'm a scribe. I write the temple scrolls, right? And let me show you. And he gets the scrolls down, unrolls them, and he gets the little pointer pen out to go through and read his Hebrew. And he says, let me find the passage. I'll show you. And he's reading, and all of a sudden he drops his little pen, his little pointer pen. His face gets bright red. He covers his face with his hands. He dances on one foot and then the other around the couch where we are, and he's, like this, like he's in pain. And Richard and I are looking at each other thinking, what is wrong with this man? And then he stops, and he says, will you forgive me? And I said, okay, for what? He says, come, look. And he says, I have written these scrolls. I have written them for the synagogues by hand, done all these, it takes months to do it.
And he said, right here, every time I've written it, I wrote it the right way, Melchi, rather than Melech. And he said, I've thought that it said the other thing. My mind went the other way. He said, I've written it correctly, but interpreted incorrectly. Tell me again what you found. So I did. And now then, he started bringing down books that I would never, ever see, photographs, drawings, and stuff that I would never get my hands on. And he filled a box that it was hard for me to carry. He said, well, look, take care of these things. They're precious. They're one-offs. But here, you know, I think you need these. And this is great, you know. And he said, let me tell you something else. Then he told me the key to the Song of Moses, how to decode that from another verse that was in there. And we started looking at the Tagine crowns then. So he let me come in and photograph the, what you won't see in reproductions, the correct Tagine crowns over Bereshit, the Genesis account. And, you know, the rule in the Zohar and in Kabbalah for interpreting the Tagine is something like, if you would see the truth of this, it's like the Zohar at sunset. If you look straight at the sun, you can't see the rays of the sun through the clouds. But if you look indirectly at the sun, to the side and not into the direct brilliance of it, you can see the fine fingers that go out from the sun. And he said, so it is with the Tagine crown. If you do not look at them directly, and this is a literal translation, then you will be able to know the message in them, which is greater even than the words of the message over which they are written. Now, we sat for a minute, and Richard, my friend, was there with us, and he says, oh, you mean like using a mirror? And once you start that kind of nonsense with the Tagine crowns, all kinds of things become evident. It's amazing. It really is amazing. There's greater stuff there, and a lot more work is required, and I think it will be done primarily by Orthodox or observant Jewish scribes and scholars. Because it is for Israel. It's not for the rest of the world.
Right. Well, we read in for the research for our first book, we read the Sefer Yetzirah, which was translated by Ariel Kaplan, who happened to be a physicist, which was fortuitous for me. EJ fought her way through it, and she found some things, and she said, "Here, read this book." So I got it, and I started reading it. Of course, it's about the Sephirot and the geometric patterns relative to creation.
Right.
And as I was going through it, I said, hey, this makes a lot of sense. This guy writes really well. And then she told me he was a physicist, and I went, well, no wonder. I see the way he's approaching this. And it just, everything just seemed to fit. And, of course, that's where the union of the polarity and how the earth was created.
You mean like the triangle from above meeting the one from below and forming the Star of David?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
That's why we put it on the cover of the book. Because people say, hey, why you have the Star of David on the cover of your book? And I say, well, actually, we have the planetary alignment from which the Star of David came from. This predates the Star of David by a few thousand years. And anyway, that's sort of to get the scholar thinking, and hey, we need to read this book, and then if you turn it over and look at the back cover, maybe you'll be inspired to read it. But interesting stuff, because as these keys are restored, and really they could not have been restored any earlier than maybe 15 years ago, because these translations just weren't done, and they were in the hands of religious scholars but not scientific people. And I think that originally this information was so technical and it was so brilliant that although it was recorded by prophets, it couldn't be enumerated by the unscientific, because they didn't have the lexicon to be able to explain it. They used religious symbolisms instead of mathematic or
absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And so it evaded a lot of people. But when scientific people got involved in the translations, very devout, yes, very well-skilled scholars, yes, but when the scientific numbers and symbols and relationships started unfolding, that's when things began to make sense. And I think it's just accelerating this method of discovery. And yours is just, a piece in the puzzle. And it is going to just explode when it gets in the right hands. And what you said earlier about the young people today being I don't know if it's the genetic stock or if it's the star child stock that's coming to the Earth or what, but the concentration of young people that are capable of understanding these deep things is much higher now than I think it's ever been in the history of the world.
And well, now, I hate to quote Dr. Phil on this, but I saw him say that the young people of today are proven to be several IQ points on average ahead of our generation. That across the board, they're getting smarter. So
well,
there you go.
That's good.
It's a fact.
and I, you know, I think largely, you know, I was talking to someone just yesterday, and she said, I wonder what my IQ is now. I said, well, when is the last time you had it tested? She said, oh, I don't know, I was 17. I said, well, you need to have it tested again because your aptitude changes your ability to learn. And when you look at, well, let's look at government schools just for about 60 seconds, and then you'll realize that anyone who came up through government schools and got the approved way of learning things got a truncated toolbox and was not really able to look at new knowledge coming down the pike. And college graduates are a classic example of this. But since 1998, the internet has just exploded. It's become the most valuable real-time library in the history of the world. And the intelligent who come home and don't play video games or watch TV turn the net on and learn.
And they
learn at an accelerated rate. And that knowledge changes their aptitude and changes their affinity for learning, which is intelligence, which is imagination. And it's having an effect around the world.
You know, it's interesting when they measure IQ, most of the major ways that they use, you get a quotient from your test results that they give you, and then they divide it by your physical age. But if you do that, if you took the same test at age 40 and then at age 80, you would have half the IQ at age you had at 40.
Yeah, but the quotient is not really a measure of your imagination. It's not really a measure of, okay, I have known knowledge, and now I'm going to give you some unknown. Can you figure it out?
Yeah, your ability to reason.
Exactly.
Rationalize.
So would you expect an 80-year-old to figure something out quicker than a 40-year-old? Not necessarily. I think that quotient is deceptive.
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying. Like say you had an IQ of 100 at 40, then your quotient would have been 400 over 40. And then you get to 80, and if you took the same test, got the same result, and a score of 400, and you divide that by 80, now then you're going to have an IQ of 50.
Right.
So they haven't allowed
80-year-olds.
Yeah, I mean, there's on that side of the curve, they haven't allowed for, I guess, you know, like senility and various other things would affect you and things like that. But it's hard past 40 to rate that curve correctly because of the variables.
You know, it's not hard to come across a vivacious 30-year-old these days that is just on fire and learning and excited about life.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you one of the really remarkable things. How many vivacious 50-year-olds can you run across today? I mean, they are absolutely on fire. They're in love. They're starting businesses. They're taking risks. They're at a point in their life where they've raised their kids. Their kids may be out of college, and they're ready to start doing things. And they're doing exciting things.
Yeah, yeah. I you know, there's certainly a lot more of them, and I agree with you. I think it's the information explosion that's done it, and the internet, so that they could reach out from the standard method of doing business or interfacing with libraries and just grab knowledge like crazy.
Well, I tell people I don't even buy green bananas anymore. I'm not about building a career or taking time developing my skills. I'm there. I'm ready to start, peeling the banana and eating it. I'm not waiting around for anything to ripen. Well, listen, Earth Explorers, my great guest is Stan Dea. We have blown through this first hour in about 10 minutes. Let me take a quick commercial break. We will come back, and then we'll ratchet this up to the next level. So don't go anywhere, and we will be right back after these messages. Don't go away. Brookside New here with X Squared Radio. know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your never-ending life is the first in the Universal Learning series from Sandy Andrews. Search your higher mind. Find your soulmate. And know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours. And your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrews at X Squared Radio and order the book today. There is something about to happen to the Earth. You know it. You can feel it. Well, the creators of the Kill Shot have collected the evidence for you in a stunning new documentary called The Horizon Project. The first DVD is now in print, and you can get it by clicking on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio. Believe me when I tell you, this may be the most important video production you will ever see. This is destined to air on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel, but you need the uncut version. Click the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio and get your copy today. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysm. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPack has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or a whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPack is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
Explorers to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our guest tonight is Stan Deo. His website is standeo.com. Author of numerous books and developer of technology for detecting earthquakes. Our first hour just caught on fire, and we went off in an area that just fascinates me, and I know it fascinated you. And if you want to call in and ask a question, we have some numbers you can reach us at. Inside the United States, you can call us at 877-876-5227, toll-free. If you're outside the U.S. in Canada, you can call us toll-free at 888-810-8322. Anywhere else on the planet, or even off-planet, you can reach a cell phone tower. You can reach us at 530-876-3222. And you can also, if you want to reach us on AOL Instant Message, you can send a message to me directly. My username is Vision Officer. And you could do the same thing on Skype if you want to. We provide a variety of ways for you to get a hold of us and get us this information, get us your questions. We also wanted to let you know about our archives. A couple of weeks ago, we started charging a small fee, $2.50, if you want to have access for 30 days. Of course, you can access everything going all the way back to September of 2005 that way. Or if you want a year's worth of access, so you can listen while you're working on your favorite project at work or download it to your iPod, you can subscribe for a full year for less than the price of a cup of coffee for an entire month. No problem whatsoever. Those are the ways you can get a hold of us. I wanted to maybe take this up a notch here. We talked about earthquake prediction. We talked about interpreting ancient scrolls and a new method of deciphering Hebrew and the things that you might have discovered there. And I noticed that you have written on and have shown a great interest in something that I'm interested in, too, and I guess the listeners are, too, and that is the subject of stargates. I was going to ask you, did that subject ever come up in the ancient writings as well? It probably did. But what have you learned about stargates?
Well, obviously, I suppose most of your listeners have at least seen one episode of the Stargate series. There's a circular ring through which super beings came to Earth and from other galaxies, et cetera, and ruled as gods in the ancient Egyptian times and Sumerian times, and then went back through the gate to wherever they came from. The story on TV is certainly different than what is in the archaeological records. We have a stela here that we're analyzing from the time of Marduk, and it was fractured and damaged by moisture and a few other things, but we were able to salvage part of a floor plan of the top floor of a ziggurat temple for the gods to come and go through a gateway.
And, really?
Yeah, and well, we're still working on it. I haven't published yet, but The ziggurats were designed in a peculiar way. They had levels, they weren't like a smooth-sided, four-sided pyramid. They were four-sided, but each level had kind of a walkway around it, and then you would open a gate or a doorway and go down to the next level of its portico or porch area where you would walk around. And then another one, and you would step down through many of these from the top of the ziggurat down to the bottom. And
mm-hmm.
at each station or each level where you would dwell for a while, when the gods were coming through the gate at the top,
the locals would go up first and put food and other things to for the gods, in quotes, to occupy themselves with while they de-energized. They would come through glowing, and they would have to let their energy normalize to our energy level. And so they would do it in stages, coming down, gradually dissipating their charge, we think, until they got to the bottom. And if you were unfortunate enough to race up there and try to touch one of them up at the higher level of the ziggurat, you would probably die from electric shock.
Sure, couldn't stand the glory of it.
But that's it. And look at Moses. I mean, you know, he was up on the Mount Sinai with God for 40 days and nights, and when he came back, it was several days, maybe longer than that even, that he had to hide his face when talking to people because his body glowed.
Yeah, they said that his face glowed his entire life.
Well, I didn't know it had gone that long, but what evidence we'd seen, it was it certainly, for quite a while, he had to hide his face while he talked to them because of the brilliance of it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously his atoms, his very atoms, were so much more packed with energy than the surrounding that he was radiating light. And when he was like up in the presence of God the first time with the burning bush, he had to shuffle and crawl on his hands and knees to keep from getting zapped. They, you know, God wanted him to take his sandals off and to shuffle so that he was in close contact with the ground as he approached to the light, so that he wouldn't build up a differential charge and an arc jump over his shoes and kill him, or stun him anyway. A number of cattle have been killed this way near high tension lines during low fog but high voltage conditions of a storm. The cow will be close to the bottom of the tower where the power line goes, and a short will occur, and it'll go down to the ground where the cow is. And some of them have got stuff on their hooves, you know, that insulate them partially from the ground, clays and whatever. And it would strike them and kill them because they weren't connected straight to the ground. It was good conduction to stay in the field. But anyway, that's what was happening with the ziggurat. And what we think, from what we can read in other documents, are these aren't all Hebrew. Some of them are from the Sumerian tablets and stuff that have been translated. And there's still a 250,000 tablets left in Ebla, to stone tablets, to be decoded or deciphered as well.
250,000 could take a while to translate.
Yeah, there's just not enough time and people and money to do it all. But bit by bit, things like this are leaking out. And it's like, instead of going to a different part of our universe through a stargate or, you know, to another galaxy or something, what they're talking about is that they go to a place right around us, a parallel universe, and that there are at least, as far as we can determine, at least 7 levels of energy density universes right concentric to our own universe. And to try to explain that, it's like Earth has 6 other Earths around it, 5 above it and 1 below it in energy density, and we all share the same space but at different frequencies. And we pass through each other, so we don't know that the other universes are there. And that's how they can be parallel or concentric to our own. I prefer to call them concentric universes rather than parallel, because they're right. All the mass in our universe apparently has identifiable entities of itself in other universes, but concentric to where it's located, you know, concentric suns, concentric planets, et cetera, et cetera. I draw this from a number of sources from the old writings, and one of them is, you know, that things were created in the spirit before they were created in the earth, you know, as solid things, as it is above, so it is below, that kind of stuff. It all plays out at a higher level to us and then manifests here in the solid level on level 6 or whatever we are. So I think that we're integrated, linked to these parallel universes or concentric universes above us and below us. And I think time passes at different rates, the higher the energy density as you go up. A day with the Lord in his presence at his level is like 1,000 years with man at his level. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that's consistent with physics, too. As you get into higher gravity or higher energy realms, time moves slower relative to other realms. So, in other words, our clock ticks by very quickly when compared to his clock.
You're talking black hole effects, aren't you? Horizon effects.
Yes, horizon effects, although you don't even have to get to a black hole to see those effects. You know, shuttle pilots have their time slow down, and they're only traveling at about 18,500 miles an hour, but their clocks do slow down relative to ground control clocks. If you accelerate matter to many times that, say, half the speed of light, you're going to see a much more dramatic change. But that's just the straight mathematical physics of it. If you talk about actually accelerating the matter to a higher vibrational frequency, not just sending it through space at a higher velocity, you accomplish exactly the same thing, although that's more difficult for people to imagine. When we first published our first book and we talked about the union of the polarity and the fact that there are two Earths occupying the same space right here, one vibrating at a higher frequency, one at a lower frequency, and right now they're in harmony.
Well, I hadn't seen your book, but that's exactly, you know, I would say, yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it went over a lot of people's heads, but we pulled that information out of the Zohar.
All right.
And it all fit together. And of course, what I did is I supplied the physics, and EJ supplied the ancient manuscript and the archaeology to back it up. And that's, I guess, why the book became a national bestseller. A lot of people caught on to that idea. But I never figured out, at least in that book, that there could be a connection between the two universes. That at least the ancient records, what they seem to indicate is that there was a fall from that higher to the lower.
Yep, yep, yep.
And one cannot just vibrate themselves autonomously to the higher level. You could fall, but you can't go up. That takes outside influence, or it takes
It takes a gateway. And remember the Tower of Babel of Bab El, the gateway to the gods. The Tower of Babel, in the Hebrew translations, you know, the real fine translation, it's let us go down and knock down their tower before they ascend their tower and become as one of us. There was a way.
Unqualified as one of them, right.
Okay, so it would be possible with the proper gateway to go up the levels. And I think that's why it was torn down and people were scattered and knowledge was kind of blurred for a long time to prevent that, because it wasn't time. In fact, I guess it wasn't a done thing. But you know, you said about time alterations and Einstein's thing about linear flight or orbital flight to changing the rate at which time passes.
Mm-hmm.
You brought up a very good point, and that is this: when Einstein drew his assumptions for general relativity about the faster you approach the speed of light, he did not limit it to the speed of light in one direction and then back in the other direction, oscillating back
right,
and forth.
That's the classic paradox. They say, well, you have perfect symmetry, so therefore there's no change. Well, we're not talking about symmetry here.
No, but you can vibrate and have an average speed at near the speed of light, or beyond, actually, if you do it right with the toroidal structures. But
yes.
The point is that he made the statement. He based on data that was a bit flawed, but it still works.
Mm-hmm.
And it works whether you're expanding and contracting a sphere or a torus spinning around a center with a hollow core to it or whatever.
Right.
It's relative motion relative to something. It doesn't have to be in a straight line or a simple orbit. So once you start to vibrate your molecules or your atoms, you know, oscillate them, pump them up, and they're all doing it together, then you're going to glow, and then you're going to be able to be in another level. Fascinating stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And of course, there's the implication that one has to become more, and I'm going to use a really unscientific word, one has to become more righteous in order to vibrate at this higher frequency. You've got to become more glorified, or you have to be transfigured by a higher being in order to get up to this point. And I think all of that is legitimate. All of that makes sense. But the fact that electromechanically you could excite matter to that point where it would pass through, invisible to this dimension, into another universe is completely feasible. And they may have actually done it with a ship during the Philadelphia experiment.
Yes, I think that they certainly did something weird to them. They pumped them up. And I suppose, from what reports I think are reliable, I've been able to read on that the main thing that happened was that the crew did become energized. So did the craft, for that matter. And they went into accelerated time on the crew, which would indicate to me that they were of lower energy density inside the field, but higher outside. For them, they spent several hours chugging back to their Norfolk dock and then back out to where they were in the test area. But to those observers, it was only a few minutes. So, in essence, they were like the hummingbird, living very fast. But to them, it was all normal speed.
Right, right. Yeah,
so I'm not sure whether
they
actually went parallel dimension or concentric universe or not, but certainly they were working at that because the coil structure they used, the three-axis coils, they are like what I think you would have, what we could find for a gateway.
One of the guests we had on this program several months ago, his name was Marco Rodin, great mathematician, and he is the inventor of the Rodin toroidal coil.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to. How do you spell his name?
It's Marco, M-A-R-C-O-R-O-D-I-N.
All right.
Of course, you can access the archive. I'll send you a coupon where you can access that. But he is always looking for a way to make these coils bigger and more refined. But he believes with enough power you can actually create a black hole, create an opening using these toroidal coils. The amount of the way that it creates its magnetic field is not the classic north-south pole kind of flux lines. It actually creates a magnetic tornado.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the way the flying saucers work on electric gravity.
Yeah. I want to cover that in more detail too. But now, what about? Well, I know this is going to stretch things, but I have a feeling you can handle it. We talked about electromagnetically inducing this kind of acceleration, but it appears that there have been figures in history, at least recorded in scripture, who have been able to accelerate their being through their own will or through their own ability. And specifically, I guess I'm talking about the emotion, well, maybe not the emotion, but the force of love, to increase a level of love to the point where you transcend this life or transcend this dimension. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, but whether or not any of us other than the Messiah himself could do that at this point in our development, I don't think so. But
I don't think so either, but I, like you, occasionally have these dreams or visions, and I don't see myself doing it, but I see maybe how it was done.
Well, let me tell you something interesting. Holly woke me up one night here, I guess it's last year or so. We study a lot of things like I know it's got a bad rap in the press, but the rapture theory about people, a certain portion of the population being pulled off by the Messiah and then brought back later in their new, you know, bodies, probably from the parallel universe. But based on this, she had this dream, and in which she saw us kind of being kind of pulled up by the nape of our neck out of our bodies as glowing entities, right? There's been another person that had a dream of the atoms vibrating and giving off light as we were pulled out of our bodies in this rapture event. Now, to me, that sounds like someone helping us make the jump to that harmonic state where we can exist in that concentric universe. You see what I'm saying?
There you go.
I couldn't argue that point at all. I agree.
Yeah, it's almost like instead of stepping into a gate or a chamber of some kind and applying electricity or magnetic energy, a higher being actually just takes your hand and accelerates you to that point, and you're able to pass through.
Right. Right.
Well, it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
You know, in fact, yes, think about this. What did Jesus say? He said, "I am the way, I am the door. Knock, and I will open, and you can enter." Now, in the Middle Eastern cultures, the Bab is a door, and the El is the Elohim, or God, and the Bab El is the gateway or the doorway of God.
That's right.
And Jesus is saying to you, I am your Bab El. Isn't that interesting?
And in fact, I was having a discussion with someone the other day, and they were talking about religion and church. And I said, wait a minute. Religion and church has nothing to do with this. In fact, really, religion and church had very little to do with Jesus' mission at all. He didn't come to set up a church. In fact, he was kind of mad at the church when he got here, and he certainly didn't set up a religion.
Yeah.
What he was doing was teaching us how to love.
Absolutely. But you know, being the author, or part of the author of the planet, the blueprint for planet Earth and all things there, he knew and knows how all things work together in harmony. That's really love in its greatest form. And here we are stumbling around blind, trying to figure out by mistake how everything should work together. And sometimes, in fact, a lot of the times, way too late, we learn how it should have been.
Or we learn that we can apply force and we can murder to get gain, and we can assemble armies, and we can become great in this dimension, but I think in the end you're going to die an ignominious death.
Well, all that's going to change, hopefully, in just the next decade or so.
That's what I'm thinking as well.
Well, I look forward to it. I tell you what, it's the way we've messed up the planet now, it's terrible.
Yes, and when you say we, I'm with you, but, you know, we're a cheek-turning people. We're not an aggressive people. We're quick to forgive, and so therefore we're easy to walk over, and we're easy to conscript into various things because we're just not a very forceful people. We'd rather go to the wilderness than take up arms against one another, and so consequently, violent men have been able to come to great power in this world. But about a month ago, in the latter part of August, I was at a gathering in Trout Lake, Washington. It was called the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference that was put on by James Gilliland. And I went with curiosity. I went as a presenter, a speaker. And I was so affected by the people there. I was so affected by the great love and the great curiosity and great openness that was prevalent among these people, much more so than the scientific or engineering community around whom I normally hang.
Yeah.
But the thing that I was exposed to for the first time, I've seen photographs, I've seen web shots, and I've seen emails that people have sent me, but the thing I was exposed to firsthand there was this energy phenomenon which in the UFO community is called orbs. And I have to admit, even with very little skepticism, after I saw how the photographs were taken, I was there when the photographs were taken, I was very impressed with the presence of what appears to be organized energy at a higher frequency, a little bit beyond what the human eye can see and certainly what film can pick up, but digital has a little bit higher frequency sensitivity. And I was wondering if you had any information or could enlighten me a little bit about the phenomenon of orbs.
Well, only to say this. I mean, I have heard of the phenomenon, and I have not been able to do as you have done, obviously, to witness the photography and the physical means by which they were detected and recorded. But I do recall Jesus saying that, Father, forgive them, for they are blind, they cannot see. And I often wonder, because he could see the spirits and stuff around us, which we couldn't, if it wasn't referring to the same region of existence as you're talking about with these orbs. In other words, there are things around us that we can't see because they're out of our visual range, but there are frequencies that can be seen if you're gifted with that kind of an eyeball or a sensory equipment.
And one has to wonder, you know, what are they looking at? Why are they here? And one of the things that I noticed is that when you went out to this field below Mount Adams, when there weren't any people there, and you just ran the camera, there was very little, maybe one or two small little things. But when the people got out there and, you know, they were sitting down, but they were all of like mind, and they were really stretching forth their hope that not that they would see a sign, but their hope that the world could live in peace and in love, and just tremendous amount of companionship among these people, very peaceful, very loving people. then when the photographs were taken, the sky, the air was just filled with tens of thousands of these things. And we, this the camera, and by the way, the photographer's name was Michael Ledwith. I know you know him as the author of What the Bleep, and he gives a great presentation. But he also had some very high-tech equipment, 10 megapixel cameras, and a way of mounting this on a tripod and then letting it flash every 10 seconds for 40 seconds so that you could see a time perspective, so you could see it wasn't bugs or dust or something like that.
I was going to ask whether it was dust in the out of focus.
Yeah, and then we blew him up. And in several photographs, he was in them. He would go out and stand in the photograph to give the camera a point of focus, to give it, you know, something to zero in on. And then we blew those up to a 30-foot screen in a dark room and looked at them, and the detail that was inside of these things was just phenomenal. Just all kinds of geometric shapes and little machines and all. Just, it was, I have to admit, I was really taken aback. I thought that they were just out of focus digital shots of dust particles, but 10 seconds apart, you see such a huge difference in the composition based on the emotion and the collective, I hate to call it a consciousness, but the collective intent of everyone who was there. It seemed like that the concentration of them would go way up when everybody was concentrating on it, and then when everyone stopped and we thought about something else or broke off the train of thought, they went away. So there was a cause and effect, which I looked for as a scientist, and there was some independent way of taking the pictures, not somebody hand-holding the picture and directing it out of focus, but it was an automatic kind of thing. And it was very high high-level equipment, and I was quite fascinated with it.
You know, while we're discussing that, if these are beings or sensory devices for beings or whatever around us, it's interesting to note that in the historical accounts of the gods visiting man, that they were always attended by burning and fire in the sky as they came down and appeared, right? And but yet when you had visitations, even now in whether they be myth or whether they be truth, you have visitations of ghosts or disembodied spirits, the room traditionally gets cold, whereas when an angel visits, it was warm. You see what I'm saying? A messenger from the higher levels. And so each level has its own energy density, and therefore the at our level, we're just at one of those seven levels. We're sandwiched in between a cold spot, a cold existence, and a warmer existence. And
yeah, relatively speaking, colder or warmer.
Yeah. So you know, it drains energy out of us when a ghost or a being from the lower energy density that we share the space with, when they try to pour it into our existence, however they do that. It drains energy out of us, and we drain energy out, or our universe drains energy out of those beings that come from the higher levels down to give us messages. And that's why they're glowing and bright, like Moses was. There's just so much, as you well know, that from a scientific perspective, now that we're starting to learn the rules of this universe, that is understandable about all these miracles and things that were oddities. We're now beginning to understand that they're, that the religious scholars and stuff just didn't know enough without what knowledge we can give, and we didn't know enough without what knowledge they can give us. When we work together in harmony, all of a sudden we're starting to understand things for the first time.
Yeah, I really think that's the key, because you're scientific people, and I have to admit I'm a descendant of that, although I consider myself a little more enlightened than the average religious, or should I say religion of science person.
Yeah, the high cathedral of science.
Yeah. The high priest of the PhD. What I saw in the scripture, Jesus trying to teach people, I didn't really go and say, well, you have to obey the law or you're going to fall to one of these lower energy levels. What I saw him teaching people was not law, and it wasn't church, and it wasn't obedience to any particular ordinance or another, but it was more raising your energy level to the point of peace, to the point of unconditional love. And if you can do that, then all these things open up to you. Then you become able to transcend all, to return to heaven, or whatever you want to describe that. And I've had a couple of people instant message me. John is asking about prayer. Can we change our frequency using prayer? And I think that the record shows that yes, you can, but not by just praying for higher frequency. You've got to try to raise your energy level by raising, or raise your vibration level by raising the level of,
and
for
what
lack of a better word, love that's in your heart instead of
guile
and hatred.
Sorry, go on.
No, go ahead. I just finished my thought.
I didn't mean to overtalk you, but Jesus himself said that no man comes into the Father, in other words, to his kingdom, except through me. I'm the doorway.
Yeah.
So when you pray for him, the doorway, to do what is necessary to get you through. And that might take a whole restructuring of your mental attitude and you know what you are, and it may take more than just a few seconds. It might take, you know, years, but I think we do have to change our ways and be more peaceful, more harmonic as best we can in a world that's full of chaos, and say to him, look, I've done all I can, you do the rest, and, you know, whatever you say, you know.
He's
the master of harmony. I mean, the chaos is evil. Harmony is order. Is you know, that's good.
So it's chaos and pushing toward chaos that drains our energy, and it's pushing toward seeking order and seeking cooperation and care that raises our frequency.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're living in the most wonderful time in all human existence to be able to be alive and understand these things in the physical bodies. You know, that were mysteries for thousands of years before us. I mean, we're just so lucky to be here.
I do, too. I feel exactly that same way. And I think maybe there were civilizations that maybe reached their zenith on this planet who understood that, maybe a lot better than we do, by and large, and they were able to, maybe they were able to save themselves when an Earth cataclysm came and threatened to, you know, physically make it impossible for them to live in that particular land. Maybe they were able to escape using this method.
To use a Stargate term, they ascended.
They ascended. Ah, very good, very good. And the idea of a Stargate being used from higher levels to come to this level is interesting to me as well, because I have to ask two questions. One, why would they do that? Why would you go from an area of higher glory or higher vibration or a higher universe to a lower universe? What is the purpose in doing that?
You've asked me a question that is loaded with information. Okay. As I understand it, and certainly I'm not the world's, you know, final authority on this, but from what I could get from a lot of the old records, Earth that we live on, this level, is a virtual courtroom resolving a conflict that occurred up at a great level there, a challenge to authority or to the order of things to be changed. And rather than fight at those levels, a virtual reality was created here, and we are the things in that virtual reality to show what would happen if the upper levels were allowed to invert the order of things and breed chaos, how it wouldn't work. And our virtual reality down here has been perverted several times, many times, by those who challenge the authority of the established order of God, that being Lucifer or Satan, whatever name you want to put on it. And as a result, there are a lot of people here in this, if you wish, computer virtual model of existence for the higher levels who don't even, who will not continue after this model is closed down at some point in the future. There are, however, many people here who have been given the assurance that once they understand what it's about and they allow themselves to be, as the church says, saved, but in other words, sign on to the established order, to God, and are in harmony with that, with him, then they will be allowed to go beyond, to live beyond this virtual reality when it's closed down, when it's through, and they will live where God lives, you know, or where Jesus lives. And so this whole thing has been a conflict revolution, a resolution here on the earth, and it's not over yet. There will be some battles fought here in our time in the next 10 years that are going to be, 10 years in my estimate anyway, that are going to be the last great battle before the millennium, and then at the end of that time, the last great battle of all this will occur, and it'll all be over then and finished.
and a new heaven and a new earth will replace all of this. But until that time, right now we're seeing a wave of these beings being cast down from their dimension to our dimension, and I think that's a lot of the alien reports we're getting and saucers and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we're seeing them cast down here, gathering for the real last battle physically with the forces of the Messiah when he comes through into our level sometime in the near future. That's kind of a quick overview of what we think we've discovered from putting all these factors together.
Do you think they're all cast down, or do you think some are coming down voluntarily to help, to lend a hand?
To lend a hand to who? The rebellion?
No, to lend a hand to defend those have the capability of rising.
No question about it. The Bible says that those who are his, or the Messiahs who have signed on with him, there is at least one angel for every person signed on, every believer. That make sure they don't stub their toe unnecessarily. I mean, so those beings are here around us, I'm sure. And
What about those that have chosen a mortal life to come here and to live among us and grow and to try to remember who they are and who they came here with, their soulmates, if they should happen to be so lucky to join up in this life as mortals? Jesus did it. Michael did it. Gabriel did it. Why not others?
Well, I know that the Messiah did. I don't know about Gabriel and the rest. They were here, but I don't know if they had to actually have multiple incarnations in this world. The beings that came from the upper levels to here had what appear to be physical bodies because they could sit and eat, like with Abraham in the desert and things like that. But their bodies are different to ours in a number of ways, I'm sure. So what you're talking about, though, is more like somebody choosing from that level to incarnate here. And I think, other than the Messiah himself, I'm not sure that anyone else has.
The Messiah, though, was half God and half man. We're talking about coming here as a spirit, joining up with a regular body created by a man and a woman the normal way, except that the soul, the complete being, the physical body and the spirit body are made up of an ancient soul, an ancient spirit, who comes here with experience and wisdom well beyond his years or her years, and maybe pairs of them, soulmates, that actually meet up and marry and realize their purpose. And I have to admit, I have met people who are in normal Earth years are old, but they're not old.
Well, Brooks, I can't really talk intelligently on that because scientifically I have no proof that we do reincarnate or have that kind of stuff going on. I know there's an ongoing debate about what was left in the Bible, what wasn't, but and even like in the Torah or the Mishnah, probably more, where they talked about and in the New Testament where Herod says, "Are you the spirit of Elijah or to John the Baptist and stuff like that?" So they were thinking about reincarnation, talking about it at that time. But the court's still out on that, as far as I'm concerned, because there are statements that say it is appointed for man to die but once, and I don't know whether that meant die spiritual or die physical or both. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
One way or the other.
But I guess I got to a point in my life where I realized that to rebel against man's religion, in the sense that I want to keep an open mind and accept anything that sounded or felt true or good, and try to, just leave my mind open until such point that I decide that, I've got enough information now, I'm going to rule that out.
Right.
I just think that this is a universe of choices and of free will, and that as a resurrected being or as a heavenly being, we have the choice to come or not. And we can come multiple times or one time. Depends on how we want to serve one another. If we think we can come here as a...
Why do you say this? What information convinced you of that?
Well, I think it would change the nature of this interview. But that's a great question.
That's a scientific question. I'm just asking what your data set is, that's all.
I don't normally take measurements with my feelings or my physical body or the way that I feel.
All right.
But I have to tell you that events have happened in my life that defy normal measurement, and I can't rule them out because they feel so good and they feel so true. And I've seen young people, 16, 17 years old, who are not 16 or 17 years old. I mean, yes, they are. I've known them their whole lives. But their intellect, their wisdom, their ability to reason, their ability to think beyond themselves, not so much I'm hungry, I want to eat, I'm lustful, I want to fulfill that need, I want to drive fast, I want to be fast, like most teenagers. These individuals are different than that. They see and feel forces that are available in the universe and instantly gravitate to those things that are true. And I have to think to myself, these are not ordinary spirits that are coming to the earth right now. And it's quite possible to me, and quite feasible to me, that individuals who realize that, like you, we have maybe 10 years to make or break the human race, and we have to try to save as many people as we can, what level would we go in our love for one another, in our volunteering for one another, to come and serve? Would we give up the serenity of heaven to come here in mortal form again and suffer and love again in this environment to help one another?
You ask a question that I can't answer. Maybe you've had an epiphany along these lines, but I have no evidence in a Greek sense, a logical sense, to say yay or nay about that. I other than the fact that the scriptures do say that during the 1,000 years after the end of this age, that the earth will be repopulated rapidly, very rapidly, with families of 10 or 12 being just quite normal.
Yeah.
And that the beings here during that time will be ones who did not get a fair chance of their own free will in this age to accept or reject the terms of harmony put down by the Messiah, by God. And they will be given a chance to do that. And at the end of that 1,000 years, where everyone will have very long lives, like hundreds of years long, the rebellion will once again be allowed to surface, Satan and his crew, out of wherever they're imprisoned. And they will gather from the people living at that time, and the souls living at that time, those who would join them in the rebellion, in the chaos. And then that's when the final battle takes place. So what I'm trying to emphasize by that is that the people that are apparently born into the body then to get a second chance or a fair chance at making a free will choice for salvation would have had to have been alive once already. Do you see? That does speak at them being born again into a physical body for a fair test.
Right.
Say like someone that was raised in some exotic Hindu or, Muslim clan or a David Koresh type extremity or whatever.
Or born in slavery or
aborted
or...
So that speaks of reincarnation at least once. So
mm-hmm.
Being fair and being scientific about it, truly scientific, I would say, well, I don't know. I need more information.
Yeah.
That's as fair as I can be about that.
Well, I have the same classical training, I sense, that you do, and I see that resurrection or a restoration into at least a higher level body that's able to live disease free and maybe have all the hair restored. Just that I'm interested in that part right there. But given a fair chance to live out a full life and be able to experience the things that would complete a soul. And I guess when I look at it scientifically, I say, well, what's fair? Well, there's only one being in the universe that can decide what is fair and what isn't, and that would be God, I guess. But what kind of plea would a person make to the Father or to the Creator or to God or whatever name you want to assign this ultimate Creator, for him to grant them a chance to come back and finish that life. If they were just snatched out of the jaws of, you know, right when things were getting good, you know, a storm came by and killed them all, or they froze to death, or war, or disease, or whatever, could they go back and finish? And if they can do it once, then logic tells me they must be able to.
Why is it that they would be able to petition that at all? It's by the grace of God that they would, that any of those souls are going to be reborn.
No question.
You see, look, for us to have an existence, a community in the upper levels that works in harmony in all things, we have to, of our own free will, allow the spirit of communication between all things in that level to flow through us.
Yes.
So it knows what we are thinking and about to do. So if we were going to cross a street, even, and accidentally step on a bug, the bug is told to move before we get there, or our footsteps are changed, so it's all in harmony, do you see?
Or the bug chooses to die under your foot.
Okay. That's an option you would have. But it allows free will to work in harmony by connecting us. And I think there are some people that say, look, I don't want anybody to be connected into my mind or my thoughts. You know, that I want to be private. I want to be an island.
Uh-huh.
But what God is saying is, receive me into your existence, into your soul, into your mind, and I will save you. You'll be part of the harmony that I am, always have been, always
mm-hmm.
will be.
Mm-hmm.
And so that prayer is one that you would say if you're aware of the offer now. But if you die before you've heard the offer, which many millions of people have done,
sure.
Then I can see it would be fair for God to say, okay, look, we use you in a virtual courtroom here, and you didn't get a fair go at this, so we're going to let you have it in this age here, the millennial age, where we'll sort it all out, and we'll give you all free will choice to accept the harmony of being connected to us all or not. It'll be your choice. And those that don't just won't continue to exist. Those that do will exist thereafter eternally.
I have tried to follow this to its logical conclusion. I've meditated on it many times, and I don't know that we can get to it in this program or even in several programs, but
understood.
The idea is that not only is this possible, but it is manifesting itself before our very eyes, and there are entities out there who are trying to short-circuit that process electromechanically, trying to come into this dimension or leave this dimension going into another, and that, although possible, may be contrary to the original design, and that may be the source of this whole battle in the first place.
Well, I met one fellow who was way into Kabbalah to the point that he was really into witchcraft and summoning demons, and this was down in Fremantle, just south of Perth in Australia. And he invited me to this large warehouse that he had, I don't know if he bought it or leased it or what, but he had one set in there, a lab, where he built his toroidal coils, his Tesla coils,
mm-hmm.
and his technical work was absolutely brilliant, superb stuff, I mean, state-of-the-art. And he called me because he had heard that I had built a toroidal coil that had worked once, burned out, and wouldn't work again. He had the same problem. He wanted me to come help him fix his. And I went with another friend of mine from the church, and one of the deacons there, and because we worked together on a lot of scientific stuff. And
mm-hmm.
I looked at Kim, and because we could see things weren't right, and just sense it. And while I had the guy's attention, Kim was lifting pages on desks, papers, looking behind calendars, and he started to find things written in Hebrew, which were like the sword and things like that, things from Kabbalah gone bad.
Right.
And he pointed to me with his hand and raised his eyebrows and said, look, you know, motion behind this guy's back. And I thought, uh-oh. So Kim says to this guy, he said, look, can I use your restroom, you know? Oh, sure. Just go down that hallway and stick to the left. And so Kim went on out to explore the factory. This big warehouse is what it was. It had been there for probably 80, 90, 100 years even, because it's where they had ships come in at the seashore there at Fremantle and the port, and deposit people and supplies there. So this warehouse had cellars and basements to it, and locks, you know, lock rooms with bars and stuff like that. Well, anyway, Kim went exploring, and just not far down the hall from where we were, he found this room built in the middle of the factory that was all kind of by itself but connected to down that hallway. And he peeked in the window, up the door, it's a little circular window you could just see through, about the size of, you know, your fist. And he got the start of his life, because inside this room was the pentagram on the floor, the little candle things around the edges of it, seats for everybody, the master's chair up there with the horned goat up over the thing, and really just all quite evil and demonic. And it dawned on us what this guy was trying to do. I got to go see. I took my turn to go to the bathroom, too, and go look. This guy was trying to gate demons into those areas. And whether he succeeded or not, I don't know, but it's exactly what you're talking about. He was trying to electromechanically open the gateway for them.
Well, if it's being tried to open from this end, then certainly it's being tried to be opened from the other end. And that's the frightening thing to me, is that the technology is technology. Truth is truth. And even used or misused, it still functions.
That's right. You remember in the book of the Revelation of John, where it's talking about an angel goes down and opens up a pit and things come out of it? That's probably to the lower level, you know, to the lower level, at least one that we know of, you know, hell, Hades, wherever they are anyway, those disembodied beings to us. And this messenger from the heavens goes out there, or goes down here and opens that gateway. Now, maybe what they're trying to do electromechanically, the bad guys here, won't work until it's time, until God says, okay, let them open the doorway, go push a button and let them access it. And the reason I say that is because when I tried my toroidal coil, and it bent the light in the room, bent it all straight into the coil like it was a magnet for light. It just, like everything was painted on saran wrap or something, just stretched into the coil. And then the coil went like that, and I could never get it to work again. Well, this guy, the demonic type guy, said he had done his and found out that if he built a new coil and moved it to a new location, it would work once and then stop. And it was like when you'd open up a doorway, someone would plug it. So it wouldn't work anymore.
Right. It destroyed that opening.
Until it's time. And then when the angel says, okay, it's time, because God has sent me to do it, then whoever is trying that will be able to succeed, and the gateway will open, and all kinds of nasty critters are going to come across.
Well, these
I wouldn't
critters,
want to be here during that time.
These critters, if we look at several of the ancient texts, we see that prior to kicking off mortal life on this planet, that there was a conflict in heaven, and Lucifer led a third of the host of heaven against the forces of God and was defeated and cast out or thrown down or disqualified somehow and not able to participate in the normal mortal life that we enjoy. And so, you know, they're still around. They're not destroyed. Those beings, those entities still want to come to this realm. And I think, at least from my feelings and readings that I've been able to do in the scriptures, they're not happy about being excluded from this experience. And so whatever opportunity they can take to, for lack of a better word, possess the bodies of the willing in this realm, they're going to do.
Of course. Of course. And, you know, I think the prophets go ahead in time, are taken ahead in time to look back on time. And so when they say, was cast down, sometimes what that means is they were cast down from where I was standing ahead in time, but that's a future event for us that are reading it. And so I'm not sure whether the casting down of that third has already happened or is happening as we speak.
Right. It's a process.
Yep.
That is taking place as we speak. So the trepidation that some of these entities that are coming to this planet in the form of UFOs or orbs or ghosts or mists or shadow people or whatever are evil, and some are here to help us. And it's up to us to sense which is which.
Yes, beware that the Lucifer comes in the last days posing as a messenger of light. And he's going to be so clever he'll fool even the most elect if such were possible.
Yes.
And why won't it be possible?
Even if it were possible that even the very elect would be deceived.
Yep.
Very good. Well, at the top of the hour, my guest is Stan Deo. This discussion is absolutely amazing. Don't miss the last hour. I'm Brooks Agnew. This is X Squared Radio, and we'll be back in about 6.5 minutes. You've existed for thousands of years. The new book in the Universal Learning series by Sandy Andrews called Your Never-Ending Life will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible. When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio. Just about everyone owns an inkjet printer. You could buy a printer for less than a couple of tanks of gas. But the inkjet cartridges are costly. If you buy a color and black cartridge at a national superstore, you'll spend about $80. Well, those high-priced days are now over. If you click the 123 inkjet banner at X Squared Radio, you may be able to replace a cartridge for the price of movie admission for two. Plus, every time you shop at 123 inkjet, you get a chance to win a free printer. How cool is that? Add to that the free shipping, and you have an untouchable bargain. Next time you run low on those vibrant color inks, think of X Squared Radio and start saving money. You know, thus is the place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysm. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we?
where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio, Earth Explorers. This is Brooks Agnew coming to you live from deep beneath the earth in western Kentucky. Wanted to also let you know about a little bit of progress on the North Pole Expedition. Many of you have heard about that on this program or on other programs such as Coast to Coast or Kevin Smith Show. Some developments that have taken place. As you know, about a month ago, the expedition leader unexpectedly passed away. And the group got together and decided that they wanted to have this expedition take place anyway. And so they sought new leadership. And the result of that seeking was that they have convinced me to lead that expedition, and I have accepted the role. And so that has changed the logistics and changed the operation of the expedition completely. We are in the process of establishing a foundation which will act as a nonprofit to accept funds from corporate donors who would like to see this expedition take place. Now, that means that there are 100 seats open on this expedition. This is not a cruise. This is a scientific expedition. There is a list on the website at x2-radio.com. If you follow the North Pole Expedition link on the homepage, right on the front page, about two-thirds of the way down, you can follow that. If you go to a university, or if you work for a clinic, or if you're a commercial engineer or unaffiliated scientist, you can go to this link, look at the qualifications that we're looking for, people that can run an HPLC, a gas chromatograph, a gamma spectrometer, you know how to measure magnetism or the curvature of the earth, or you're an expert astronomer, or know how to take water samples, ice samples, if you're experienced in paleobiology, paleobotany, or seafloor mapping with triple beam sonar, we can use your skills. Now, that means that your way will be paid by the foundation. We're looking for the best skills, not just people that have money and want to go on a cruise. So what you need to do is go there, send us your resume, send us your CV, and let us look through that, and we will pick through those individuals and try to assemble the best crew that we can. And that is logistically what's taking place. It also means that the cruise or the expedition will probably not take place in 2007 as expected, because by the time we raise the money and assemble this team of experts, it will be winter time again in the Arctic, and it will be dark. Don't particularly want to go in complete darkness. I'd rather go when the sun is up all the time and the ice is thin enough
that the 70,000-ton, 490-foot-long icebreaker can get through it and get to the point, get to the position where we need to go. So go there. Give us your information. If you know somebody that would be interested in being on this expedition that has qualifications we're looking for, bring it on, because we intend to go, and we intend to see. Not going to go on conjecture any longer. We're not going to go off the footnotes of dated textbooks like dogs chasing each other's tails. We're not going to go off this old 30 and 40-year-old data. We're going to go get new data, and we're going to find out about the real structure of this planet. If you're interested, join us. And that's all I have to say about that tonight. My guest tonight is Stan Dale, and we are having a fascinating discussion. It started off talking about Stargates, and because of the nature of this technology, being able to pass from one dimension or one universe to another by qualified or unqualified beings, by applying technology, we kind of opened some gateways into the more spiritual realm. We understand that, and that's just the nature of this program. We'll follow it wherever it leads us. If you want to join us, there are several ways you can do this, non-threatening ways, I promise. You can call toll-free inside the United States at 877-876-5227. If you're in Canada and you want to call toll-free, you can call us at 888-810-8322. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you've got a strong enough signal, you can reach us at 530-876-3222. Those numbers are posted at the top of the homepage at x2-radio.com or through the BBS radio network, of which we are a proud part. So, Stan Dale. His website is standeo.com. That's S-T-A-N-D-E-Y-O.com. More there than you can read in a week. I suggest bookmarking several links inside his website and keeping tabs on it, not the least of which is the earthquake prediction link. Can you give us the exact web link to that so that people can write that down, especially if they live in coastal areas and they can make that one of their favorites?
Well, the exact link. actually, if they just go to our front page,
okay,
and then click into the site, you'll see Holly's got up there Millennium Arc Welcome.
Right.
Can't miss it. It's right in the thing. And over on the right of that, it says Today's EQ Warning.
There you go.
And that's a direct link to the pages where we store that data every day. We try to get it in there by about 6 to 6:30. Sometimes before that, today it was before that, Mountain Standard Time, which would be about, on your East Coast listeners, that would be, what, about 8 to 8:30 in the evening.
Right.
And if you go there, you'll not only get that link, but you'll get a look at all the headlines that Holly thinks are of value to people of this age, you know, looking at changes occurring. It's
Well, there are a lot of Earth changes occurring. One of the things that I noticed on your website, Holly does a fantastic job of putting a volcano, earthquake, ocean, oceanographic, and even solar inputs there, so people can really have a college level, a university level resource here.
Well, you know, she does that every morning. She gets up at about 6, and it takes several hours a day to research all that every day.
Well, see, all that work put into that research, into that information, what kind of traffic do you get of people coming in from all over the world accessing this?
Oh, probably about 18,000 a day, something like that.
Well, it could be better. Hopefully this program will...
That's pretty good. I mean, I don't know, what are those are repeat visits? I suppose a few of them are, but you extrapolate that out, and you're looking at... over a million, maybe a million two visitors a year.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good.
She's. You were talking about preparation. I heard that last hour, I think, on the commercial break. Holly has written a marvelous book as well called The Dare to Prepare, and that's on preparation and points people to a lot of places to get more information on food and products. But it's discussed on our website under the banner called Shop, Dare to Prepare, and I really think if your listeners are aware, like I think they are, that they ought to have a look at the outline of our book that we've got there, which tells you chapter by chapter, subheading, to give you an idea of the scope, you know, the magnitude of what she's put together, from surviving a nuclear warfare, you know, or bio warfare and that kind of stuff, to hurricanes, floods, tornadoes. Everything you could possibly think of as a major disaster has been covered in there. So that might help your listeners as well.
Well, you know, just there's almost too much to go into in 1 hour, but I have people flash messaging me the whole show through AOL Instant Message, and I also get emails from people because they say, well, you know, what do I do to prepare? And of course, that's kind of a loaded question on this program.
It is, isn't it?
Because there are the metaphysical things that you can do to prepare, like
Absolutely. Raising
your energy level and learning this level of love and unity between human beings. That's certainly a method of preparation. I honestly don't have a religion to advise you to about that. It's more of an individual thing for me, and hopefully for you. But they also
We were talking about, though, Brooks, just before we close off last hour, about, you know, I was saying we're told to let the Spirit of God come into you. You have to give her permission, you know, to indwell you, to tie you in.
Right.
You don't have to tie that to any particular quote unquote religion or church, but that I think is the most important thing in your survival kit. And after that, it's just survival things for the body.
Sure. Sure. And that's the other emails that I get. People say, well, you know, what do I do? I live in the city, or I live in an apartment, or I'm a student. You know, what can I do? I don't want to store a year's supply of food in my dorm room. I need something that will sustain me for 2 or 3 days so I can walk to a place where I can, you know, return to my family or whatever. Do you have a suggestion for people?
Yeah, we do cover a number of, or Holly does in that book, and also on the website and on shows that we do try to address those issues. One thing for people in city situations, or like in the university, like your listener was saying, is to do like the special forces do when they go in to accomplish a mission in a city. They bury emergency supplies for however many days they're going to need to walk out of the country they're in or the zone they're in. They bury that 4 times, one on a location they know on the west side of town, one on the east, one on the north, one on the south. So no matter if 2 or 3 or 1 even of the exits out of town are blocked during the emergency, but they can walk to emergency supplies they've buried or hidden away at one of the 4 locations of the compass. You see what I'm saying?
That's an excellent idea.
And so then all you need in your dorm room would be the gear, you know, the backpack, maps necessary to get from where you are by foot. And it's not just a direct line map. Sometimes you may have to deviate to the left or right to get to your stash. And that you would have, plus, compass, plus emergency radio. I mean, there's a number of things that Holly has in the book for that to put in your backpack. That's your walkout pack to walk to your stash. And that's what we suggest those people do, because they've still got to go to college. They've still got to, some of them live in apartments because they work in town. But in the ideal situation, we tell people there's 120 cities at least in the United States that are too populous. There's population densities, and they are nuclear targets at least. Don't live in the cities. Get out at least 25, 30 miles out of these major cities, and in general terms, we say don't live anywhere on the West Coast, don't live anywhere on the East Coast, don't live in the Gulf, live west of the Mississippi, not east, and, you know, somewhere in that area for your long-term settlement. But in the short term, make provisions, like I just said, to get out of your city situation into the edge of the city situation, where you can then pick up your stash or your three-wheeler, whatever you've hidden away, to go to a safer long-term destination from where you are.
I grew up as a young boy in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area, Pasadena area, very, you know, densely populated area. And one summer I was living with my grandparents out in Simi Valley, and we had a terrible earthquake. I think this was 1969. Just collapsed freeways, broke water mains, gas mains. It was horrible. Well, it took us about, that happened early in the morning, all day long aftershocks for 2 or 3 days. So no one really wants to move while that's happening. It's just, it's debilitating, the fear that you're under at that point. But after about a day and a half without refrigeration and without clean water, people kind of get restless, and we kind of wanted to come out of the valley. So we got into my grandparents' Valiant, and we headed up the two lanes, because at that time they didn't have the freeway completed. And we got about halfway up the foothill and ran into a National Guard blockade. And we said, hey, you know, we want to get out of the valley. And they said, yeah, I know, but you can't leave. And we said, well, what do you mean we can't leave? I mean, you can't stop us from leaving. They said, oh, yeah, we can, and we are. And you all are going to stay in this valley, and we're going to bring water to you, and we'll bring food to you until they get the utilities back up and running, because we cannot have, you know, 300,000 or 400,000 people pile out of this valley into the city below. There are no resources to sustain you because they've also gone under the same earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And so we realized that we weren't free to move. So we went back to the trailer and we made do with canned goods and cereal and stuff for 2 or 3 days till they got the electricity back on and they fixed the gas main breaks and got water lines repaired. But it was probably 2 or 3 weeks before, you know, life got back to normal, so to speak, school resumed and all of that. And that was a natural disaster. And
mm-hmm.
It sort of clued me in that, you know, when I get old enough, when I got into the Air Force, I made a point never to live in a major city again. I lived in small towns, 20, 30, 40,000 people at the most, except when I went to college. And college towns tend to swell a little larger than that. But now I live in a town of about 22,000 people.
Yep.
And the countryside is a mile away from my house, and there's lots of farmland around. And I don't think that the people around here would panic too much if a tsunami took out 1,200 miles of the East Coast. But I like your advice. I think it's sound advice. I don't know what 80% of the population of the country is going to do, because that's where they live, East Coast, West Coast, and the Gulf.
I know. And they're all going to try to get out of Dodge at the same time.
Well, we saw that happen, didn't we?
Yes, sir, we did.
I was working on a contract down in Dallas when Katrina hit, and a hotel that I was at was in the Metroplex area of Dallas, which is not near what it used to be 20 years ago. It's mostly empty now, but there were some pretty good-sized factories there, and we were helping a sequencing operation supplying GM down there. But our hotel filled up in 24 hours. It filled up with refugees. Well, they didn't want to be called refugees, but they arrived with their charge cards by the busloads, and they filled up every room in that hotel, and they changed the dynamic of that city horrendously. Just in 48 hours, it was a different town, the effect that they had coming into town that way.
Now they changed Houston, too. Houston's not happy about it.
Yeah, and that was, you know, relatively speaking, that was a pretty small disaster. Really,
yep.
Only affected a few cities.
Yep.
If there was something like, and one of the things that you mention on your website are much more calamitous, not just the natural stuff like earthquakes and tornadoes. And oh, I have an IMer that asked me about the volcano in Yellowstone, the super volcano. Is that something that we should be worried about in the near future?
As far as it being a super volcano, I don't think so. However, I do think it has real potential for erupting when the plate, the portion of the North American plate that is breaking off, starts to separate. I think it will release a lot of the magma pressure that it would normally be an explosive release, which will diffuse a lot of it. But that time is probably, I don't know, it's maybe 5, 6, 7 years from now, maybe 10. We're looking at this next solar cycle, which has a lot of effect on triggering events. And there's a line of earthquakes that we can see every day on the USGS report on the Internet. And that line of earthquakes goes from Mount St. Helens, Washington, you know, up there, over to the right down Idaho, through the western side of Yellowstone Park, down through Utah, down to outlying Nevada.
Is that the Wasatch Front?
Say again?
Is that the Wasatch Front?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it goes down through there, and all of those little earthquakes are outlining that whole plate area that's going to break free of the United States.
Wow.
This is going to happen. Now,
so Heber City will have beachfront property.
It's quite possible. Actually, the fault lines run, or the quakes we're seeing run over as far as Grand Junction in Colorado.
Oh, my.
So Coloradans are reasonably certain that Western Colorado is going to be beachfront property. It's a joke. But what I'm going to now add to what your listener asked about Yellowstone is this. This is not scientific. This is now some of the dream visions I've been given about this time when it occurs. One of the dream visions was given to me because of my brother and his family who live and work in Tacoma. And it showed them trying to escape across to the other side of the volcanoes that were all erupting. And it was Mount St. Helens. It was from Mount St. Helens all the way down to Mexico City. There were something like maybe 8 volcanoes all erupting at once.
Wow.
And the ash fall, most people think of ash as dry, but ash is wet it's a wet glass, the shards, little tiny things. And the road that he was driving on with his family in his car was covered with this ash, and it was slippery, and he didn't realize. He went around a turn and slipped off the road and fell down an embankment. He didn't have enough rope to pull him and his family up out of the thing to safety. And that was the reason I was given that dream, showing all those things that were happening, and that my family, you know, would be involved, and they needed to take rope and hooks, or at least avoid slipping off the road.
Yeah.
Then another one that I had, which I have up on the website, about it was a dream which included, you know, how I would meet Holly, and where she would come from, that kind of stuff. In that dream, the last part of it, that dream vision, I'm standing with several hundred people who are like you and I, like observers and watchers of what's happening and warning people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was standing in front of this group in a desert-like area where we are now, and in the west, in Colorado somewhere. And I had to go by all these little pup tents, one-man pup tents, where all these several hundred were sleeping out there, you know, right where I was standing. And they had slept through their alarms by their cots. There was one man to one person to a pup tent, and they were covered in their cot. They were covered by this cobweb or like webbing, and I had to reach through the web and wake them up and say, "You've overslept. It's time. Get up. Come on. We got to get together and so we can tell people what's going to happen." And I woke up all these few hundred people, and they were standing in a group before me. And it was pre-dawn. It wasn't yet. The sun wasn't coming up to, you know, back over the other side of the country on the east. We were on the west side.
Uh-huh.
But there was this strange orangish yellow glow of light, no direct source, all around us in the desert. And okay, I assembled them. They were looking at me, and then I turned around and faced to the west, looking at the skies over Northern California and Oregon. And as I stood there, flaming things started to fall like a rain of fire coming down out of the sky. It wasn't like meteorites, which are swish, swish, swish like that. This was slower, trailing tongues of fire behind the pieces. And it started small and then more and then more until it was like a waterfall but of fiery things falling down over the northern skies of California. And I remember it flickering in my eyes and the light flickering on their faces as I turned around, and I said, "All right, go now and tell your people it begins now." And then I woke up.
Wow.
But that indicates something fiery burning like that, and that could be the Yellowstone event erupting that way. So to your listener, that's the major input I have on that.
Well, I know when Mount St. Helens erupted, the ash pattern from space was profound, and it did have some effect on crops and had some effect on global temperature. But as calamitous as that event was, it was fairly localized as far as the destruction went. But what I understand, this line of volcanoes, or if this entire fault were to open up and vent, is the ash fall would be significant, would go all the way over to the eastern side of Nebraska, which is just, you know, like 1,000 miles. And the result on crop production would be profound for a while.
Oh, yeah. Look, you're looking at the beginning of a nuclear winter, at least 1 year, maybe 2.
I don't think, like, the people that have signed on, as I understand prophecy and the scriptures, people who have let the Spirit of the Lord into them, who are believers in essence, will be caught up before this, and their bodies change into that new energy body we were talking about. But those who are still here on the earth and hadn't quite, you know, got their vibes right or whatever you want to call it, they are going to go through these terrible times. And for them, this is going to be horrific, life-altering, life-taking type events that are going to be global. And the beginning of it all, the major parts of it, I think, will be here in the United States. Because I think we are what the prophecies speak of as the Babylon of this age. And that Babylon is destroyed in one hour, it says, by fire. And whether that's one literal hour or one prophetic hour or whatever, I don't know how you argue that. But suddenly, the Babylon of this age, which we think is America and London, or in England, will burn and be destroyed. And this might be what I was seeing. It's one way it could happen is if you had a lot of volcanoes going off and emitting fiery stones that set alight a number of forests and things that are dry from all the drought we've had, and the winds, prevailing winds, just take it across the country and we're burned, and that's the end of it. I mean, you know, that with the people killed by the ash, the inhalation of the ash, the gases, the disruption of work, and the cloud cover or the dust cover that's going to stop the crops growing. It will be a nightmare for us, and it will spread around the planet, and eventually there will be disasters everywhere. But I think the major part will start here.
I have a couple thoughts. You mentioned in your dream that that you went to the people in the pup tents who were covered with the cobwebs, and you said, "Wake up, you know, wake up."
Yeah.
And then you said that, you know, those that are able to assume this higher energy level are going to be somehow phased away or caught up, or there are a lot of post-scriptural interpretations and words for this. Some people call it the rapture, which
yes.
is not really a scriptural term, but
yep.
but you get the idea.
Yeah.
And for me, and I think for many others, although it seems like it would be welcome to be snatched away and then watch the rest of the earth go through this, I kind of think like you do. I think I would rather be the one waking people up. I would rather stay behind and serve. If I died, so what? I mean, just a mortal body. But at least I could help others. At least I could explain to them what's going on and where they could go and what they could do to better themselves, to improve themselves, and in that act, improve myself.
Aren't you doing that now?
Well, that's pretty profound. I guess I am, but it hasn't happened yet, has it?
No, but when it does, I think the time to make decisions is over.
Yeah.
As I understand it, it's going to be a rough trot for the people for the next 7 years after that, if I understand, 7, maybe 10, depending on how you interpret the prophecy, but I think 7. And, like you, if I have to stay here and do that, okay, fine. But the good Lord knows that my druthers would be back home safe with him.
But I think in my heart, and I've searched it thoroughly over my 5 decades on the earth, I think I would choose to stay. I would choose to see it through and try to, those that were caught unaware or unprepared, like the 5 virgins, help them prepare. Stick through it with them, tribulation or not. You know, it's I have my soulmate. I have everything that I need. And
let me just interrupt that. Now, the 5 virgins, there was 5 foolish or unwise virgins and 5 wise virgins.
Yes, there were 10 virgins. 5 had to stay behind. But I know everyone else would probably want to go through to the wedding and close the door and leave the rest of the world out. But I still think that there's hope for those who have been foolish.
Oh, there is, but they're going to have to suffer some real ordeals, and some of them will have to suffer pretty terrible deaths and trials of their faith by facing beheading and stuff during that time. And if you could avoid that, or, you know, if they could avoid that, they would be wise. And that's why the parable is put there. The wise virgins were approached by the 5 foolish ones to give us some of your oil, some of your knowledge, some of your blessing,
And they said, no, we can't. We've got what we need, you know, and we can't give this to you. And so the five foolish ones then went back to find out how they could go and get their oil for their lamps and be saved as well. And it was too late. When they came back, there was no one there. And that's what it's saying. It is better to go with the five wise ones and be prepared now, early, than it is to be the five foolish ones. Because it's
I'm not saying to not be prepared, but in my thinking of that that parable, it isn't oil at all. It's tears.
It's what?
It's tears from living life, and overcoming things, suffering through things. Those people that go through life from one pleasure to another or one inebriation to another have not had the tears of suffering through to righteousness to fill their lamps. They have gone through as carnal beings, and they don't have, they can't have the life experience of choices in order to qualify, and it's not something you can go out to the store and buy.
Well, that's an interesting viewpoint. I'd obviously taken the rather pragmatic approach of saying, well, what does oil refer to elsewhere in the Bible being, used in the same code or same meaning? And I found that it could be like the Holy Spirit,
right?
And which is the indwelling of the Messiah or of God, or it could be knowledge, of His word, of His work, and His promise. So. I don't know.
And it could be knowledge of signs and times, and that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Yeah. I'd like to understand that better myself. I must confess, but
earthquakes in diverse places and seas leaving their bounds and strange weather and superstorms and things like that. I have an IMer that said that they're experiencing earthquakes in Ohio right now, which is a really
I saw that.
Strange.
Hey, how about that one down, or the two down this year in February and then this month in the Gulf of Mexico where there's no plate fracture?
Yeah. That's beyond the New Madrid Fault, isn't it?
Yes, but Jack Reed, Holly's got the articles up on our website there at standio.com. Jack Reed, who used to be a geologist with the oil company, I think one of them was Texaco. He's retired now, but he analyzed a lot of data down in the Gulf of Mexico as part of his job, and he has a map showing where he thinks the New Madrid thing, the mother of it, the head of it, is actually right there in the center of the Gulf where the Mississippi comes out, and that's all part of a huge fracture that goes all the way up into Canada and beyond, and that this is all connected, and these earthquakes there are going to become more frequent. And possibly, I guess, more higher magnitude. But that is the key, he thinks, to the whole New Madrid system.
How deep are these quakes?
Well, I'd have to look and see what the data on it said, but I don't think it was a hugely deep quake. Strange as it may sound, I normally only post earthquake warnings on my daily earthquake plot. I put a circle around the areas that are likely in the next, 0 to 5, 6, 7 days.
Uh-huh.
And I do that on known fault lines, but I had a signal so strong in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, 4, 5, 6 days ahead of it, that I put a circle around the middle of the Gulf of Mexico and saying, look, I think we're going to have an earthquake here, right? And darned if we didn't, and it surprised everybody because we don't have earthquakes there as a general rule.
Right.
But the signal came up, and it was a strong one. So if I see more like that in that area, people in the New Madrid area all the way up to the Great Lakes better worry.
Well, what do the people that live on the west coast of Florida think about a quake out there?
Well, I haven't talked to them. We have friends that live up in the panhandle, and certainly it is a few folks have opened their eyes a bit wider over that.
Did they feel it there? Did they?
Oh, yeah. The dishes rattled and things like that, and it was unusual. And some people, as I recall, were a bit excited about it or worried or whatever, but there's been a lot of calming news breaks come out and say news stories saying, look, these don't happen very often. It was unusual, but it was out at sea. And, because it's out in the Gulf, they don't worry about it. It's not in Florida itself. And they've got a fracture running from north to south through that country, through that state that, if that's triggered by all this nonsense, they're going to have to worry about it. And some of them are going to be underwater because of it.
And if an earthquake happens underwater and you have a severe shift in the level of the sea bottom, what happens to the surface?
Well, hey, the way this thing is laid out, certainly any tsunami it produced could very well go either east or west or both ways in the Gulf, and it would strike all that coastline. Look, I tell you what, Holly's book, you know, the Dare to Prepare thing tells you, you know, how to prepare a lot of stuff and a few things to look out for. And in addition to it, she's put out that the book on CD-ROM, which you have to have a computer to read. But it's got about 500 maps, you know, and then about 70 or so of those are huge maps, you know, like 2 foot by 3 foot in color. And she shows the areas to avoid, you know, on the coast and certainly in the Gulf, which states are going underwater, which we know are subsiding now. And she shows there where the subsidence is going to chew into Louisiana and to Mississippi, et cetera, and up the East Coast as well. And there's just heaps of stuff like this that people need to get their hands on if they're thinking about kind of, you know, moving their tent to a more prudent area. That's why she calls it, you know, Prudent Places USA.
What's the best way for them to get their hands on that book, Dare to Prepare?
Well, they can either order it online at our website because, you know, we're not like you where the books, you know, Barnes & Noble and stuff like that carry us. We have to do it for everybody, and so we have it on our website, and we have it here at our office at 719-547-9100, 719-547-9100. And either Holly or myself will pick up the phone and talk with them and help them out. But look, we've had so many people. After Katrina hit, we had people ringing in and emailing in after the power returned saying thanks so much to her for writing the book, because there was one lady trapped in her attic with her pets, and she had food for herself and them, and she survived till they came to get her because she'd read the book and prepared. Another guy, a judge over Mississippi, had just finished, he got the book and prepared his household, and the hurricane wiped every house around him except him, and so he became the reconstruction center for his whole neighborhood because he had power and he had food and water and everything and medicine.
Right, right.
It's just, you know, it built community just because he prepared.
Well,
so
that's what it
means. Just, you can't do any more than tell people, look, here's the answers you're looking for. Go get prepared. Go make community. We're having block parties here where we're talking to our neighbors and stuff. Look, and people want to talk about it now. They understand the need for it. And it's better to build community than to build walls and shoot your neighbor.
One of the things that we're thinking about doing next February, our foundation that we talked about earlier, in addition to putting together the North Pole expedition, and I want to ask you a question about that here in a minute.
All right.
We want to put on a convention in February, possibly in Charlotte, because all these kind of conventions always happen on the West Coast, and I, you know, we have such great scientists and such great scientific minds and inquisitive people out here, and we don't have anything like this. We want to try to bring the best presenters that we can together to share with people and inspire people that really good leading edge, although not mainstream, science is being done all over the place. And we want to try as a foundation to raise money to fund some of that science to fruition for the benefit of the world. And one of those things that we want to cover there is preparedness. I'd love for it if you were to come for an hour and talk about preparedness. So we're going to try and bring about 3,000 people together. It's just not something that's talked about out here on the East Coast. It's just mostly out in the West, Utah and Arizona, New Mexico. They talk about it all the time, but we don't talk about it out here. And so we're going to try and sponsor something like that if you'd like to.
Well,
help us,
we'll have to play it by ear. I've just recently business has taken a new turn for us and developing things that people will need during this time, but it is going to keep me real busy, and Holly too.
Well, that's good.
We'll just have to play it by ear because at this point I can't tell you no more because we're legally bound not to say anything publicly about what
sure,
we're doing.
Sure, I've got you. Well, let me ask you a question about the North Pole area.
All right.
Have you ever had any dreams, visions, thoughts, measurements, things that you've noticed about the Arctic area?
No.
Okay, that's
no.
Fair enough.
I just wanted to think a minute about that. I have nothing to tell you about that, no.
Well, I'm just trying to pull all the resources together that I can, and I couldn't pass up the opportunity.
Well, I did. I did hear you make that offer at the break, and I thought, gee, what could I do on a North Pole expedition? But I just can't go because this other thing, probably, for what I need to do, is of such higher priority for everyone that I'm going to have to do it.
I understand. Everybody has their priorities, and I know. From recent events that have happened to me in the last 90 days or so, that this is going to be. I was born for this. This is what I was meant to do, and I feel driven like nothing I've ever done before. And I've done some pretty cool stuff, but I really feel driven to do this. And I've just got a tremendous team of people helping me, and it's going to happen.
There must be a reason for it, and we'll read about your exploits when the time comes, eh?
That's right, or see the film.
See the film, yes.
You mentioned earlier the subject, we were talking kind of off the air, about UFO technology.
All right.
That you had at some point in your life thought about how do UFOs work? How do they make left-hand turns at 15,000 miles an hour in our atmosphere without smashing themselves against the passenger window?
Well, Brooks, when I was a much younger man, I was in Dallas, and I lived there, and invented a process to make circular flying aircraft using hot charged ionized gas. It was a plasma drive craft. Now, I had only conceived the idea and started working on the concept of how to make, you know, models work and to illustrate it in water and with electrolysis, various other things, or electrodes in salt water, for magnetohydrodynamics. But anyway, I was approached by a man in Dallas, Dr. James R. Maxfield, and this is all, I covered this in my book, The Cosmic Conspiracy, How It Happened. And he was an associate of Dr. Edward Teller, and he and Dr. Teller had sponsored, they said at the time, over 50 projects with other young men like myself who had discovered the secret. And they were way ahead of me and wanted to know what I'd like to work for them on their project, but had to move to Australia to do it. And that's how I got started, went down to Australia. They paved my way down there and took my family and everything down there. And it, although I did not invent it, I am aware, because I was shown how the other device worked, of doing what I was doing with hot charged air. They were doing it with magnetic fields by generating a spinning magnetic vortex around a toroidal ring, which flew the craft. How to explain a donut? Let's take a donut, and let's make that donut, instead of being the part you bite, instead of it being circular and cross section, it's now square.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a donut that's squeezed, stamped or something, but it's square section. It's not, you know, round like the normal donut, you know, on the inside.
Right.
And someone has taken a bite out of it, so you got a chunk out of it. That's like a washer, like a steel washer, that's straight on the side, straight on the inside, straight across the top, but it's got a bite or, you know, a cut in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was the cross section of the former for the 30-foot diameter craft, and that was made of a thin metal, and the inside of that was hollow. Not we're not talking about the empty part of the donut. We're talking about the inside of the part you'd bite. That was hollow. And around that former with the bite out of it, that donut, that toroid, was wrapped two coils, one layer deep. And they were flat wire, about 6 inches wide and about half inch thick.
Wow.
High current coils. They were insulated from each other. One wrapped around the inside of the donut, and one wrapped around the donut part that you would bite, around it, at right angles to the other coil, which is wrapped around the inside. Those two coils were connected by a circuit that switched the electricity flowing in one to the other one in a dog chasing its tail situation, so that you could take a Volkswagen car engine, if you wanted, and generate the electricity to pulse into one coil, and then when you finish that pulse, instead of letting the energy flow back with what's called back EMF, that current is switched ahead into the next coil at right angles to this one, and added to it is some more from your Volkswagen engine output. So you now have two amounts of energy floating in the second coil, and then you disconnect it and
before the back EMF can flow, you shunt that over into the first coil and add some more from your Volkswagen. Now you've got three amounts of energy, and you start to stack energy flowing back and forth between these two coils. Doing it this way produces a spinning field, a vortex field like Tesla was trying to do with his polyphase system, except it's not three nodes for three phase. It was continuous node spin.
And the switching is at what rate?
Well, it depends on what you were doing, but let's say what most people be aware of would be under 200 pulses a second.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Like you would hear from a hum, a speaker hum, or like an elevator hum, low-frequency pulses, but there were huge currents involved, and because they started to crowd in those conductors, there was voltage of, you know, rise a bit, and they would excite molecules, atoms around it, so they would glow.
So you're creating and collapsing these inductive fields and capturing it on the back end and reusing it.
Well, we're not actually collapsing. We don't let it collapse. We shunt it.
Oh, I see.
Shunt it sideways. I know this sounds like it's from a movie from Back to the Future, Dr. Emmett Brown, the crazy professor. But Dr. Michael Faraday said that there has to be an equivalent to the static charge capacitor in magnetism or in current. So he called it the magnetic flux capacitor. And that's what Emmett Brown in the movie of the series, Back to the Future, called his.
Right.
Now, by definition, all the capacitors that we use now are static for a point in time. They have a charge on them on one plate and an opposite charge on the other plate, and they're just sitting there, not doing anything until you drain them or charge them up.
Right.
Okay. When those charges start to move, they're no longer static. They are current. They are a charge moving over a distance in a given amount of time, so that's Q S over T. So, by definition, something to hold magnetic fields being created by current flow has to have a dynamic circuit. It has to be moving. It can't be a charge stored up in a magnetic field static. It's got to move.
That's right.
So that's why these fields pulse and move and spin, and they store layers and layers. One craft that tested in the organization I was with over in London, they tested a craft that generated from a 30-foot diameter disc a field that went out 800 feet. 800 feet. And when this thing took off, the guard that was watching was telling me, he looked up because the thing went straight up. It kind of went like a falling leaf in reverse for a second, kind of oscillated over the pad, and then went like that, and left circular rainbows behind it out of sight.
Now, was there anything in? It was just the disc itself?
Oh, it was the guys and the crew in it. They were just testing it. But
I see.
The whole field. Now, why didn't the guys and the craft fall apart from inertial stress? Here's why.
They created their own unified field.
Well, exactly. They didn't get. Change direction by a jet pushing on their backside or a wing changing direction, plane in their seat leaning, pushing them. They were all changed almost simultaneously with the field because it penetrated every crew member's body, all the members of the or all the atoms of the craft. And so when the energy was dumped into accelerate vertical, that it changed the field orientation. It changed it so rapidly throughout the whole system that nothing moved until everybody's cells and atoms got the message. So they all moved together.
Amazing, amazing. I wish we had more time because we could go another 3 hours easily.
I know, and but it alters time. I got to tell you that. For the crew on board, depending upon whether they are highly, their density changes to high or low, it changes the rate at which time occurs for them. That's why when they turn a corner at the snap of a finger at 20,000 miles an hour, to you and I, it's like instantaneous. To them, they could break out a deck of cards and have a cup of tea while they're turning
exactly.
the corner.
It's a nice, leisurely Sunday turn
yep.
for them.
Yep.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, our excellent guest has been Stan Dale tonight, and we are now out of time with X Squared Radio. I told you these 3 hours go by in about 30 minutes, and we got off into some really amazing, very cool stuff, and I hope you enjoyed it tonight. Stan, I appreciate you being with us.
My pleasure.
And I'd love to have you on again. It'll be a few months because I'm booked out quite a ways, but I definitely want to talk to you again. And we'll leave your link up at least for a year, and your archives will be available for everybody to listen to, and you can send people here.
All right.
We'll drive as much traffic as we can to your website. We appreciate you being on.
Thank you, Brooks. It was fun.
Thank you so much.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, I will play my exit. We have, again, eaten up 3 hours so quickly, it just is amazing, and I know you all will enjoy listening to this many times, because we covered a lot of great stuff and opened some wonderful doors. So have a wonderful week. Be productive, and don't forget, we have Tom Van Flandern coming on next week. We're going to talk about black holes and comets and disappearing planets, and it's going to be fascinating. So, until next week, take care of yourselves. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.